I think we're good to go.
All righty. Good afternoon. It's 12 o'clock here at the Naturopathic Medical Board meeting. I'm Dr. Bruce Sadlick. With me, we have from the Assistant Attorney General Office, Ms. Elizabeth Campbell, and our Executive Director, Ms. Gail Anthony. And we'll do a formal roll call.
Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Dr. Popiel?
Here.
Ms. Gowan?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Rubin?
Present.
We have quorum.
All right, good. Let's move on to number two, the declarations of conflicts of interest. Dr. Rubin's recused from agenda item number 7, and Dr. Popiel is recused from agenda number 5, B as in boy, C as in cat. We do have a stability policy and statement, in accordance with the open meeting law, the board has a stability policy that prohibits any type of disorderly conduct that disrupts the board from carrying out its business. Those violating this policy, I'll ask you once to modify your behavior. If you do not, we'll disconnect you. Next, I'd like to move on to number 4, consent agenda. I'd like to, with the board's permission, take 4A as an apple through S as in Sam.
So moved. Mrs. Rubin.
Dr. Rubin seconds. And we'll do a roll on it.
And Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popiel?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell?
Aye.
Dr. Spatt?
Aye.
Dr. Rubin?
Aye.
Motion carries.
And that brings us to then item number 5, review, consideration, and possible action regarding the following board cases. We'll start off with case number 5, A as in apple, and that's Dr. Tara Payman, case number 24-239. This is the initial interview, and I have Ms. Anthony give us an overview of that.
Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, according to the complaint, it is alleged respondent saw DK as a patient from approximately 2017 to the beginning of 2023. And during that time, respondent crossed the doctor-patient boundaries by developing a personal friendship with DK, including spending time with her out with her at her home, church events, and taking camping trips, all by collecting fees and treating DK as her patient. According to Dr. Valerie, DK has a diagnosis of dissociative identity disorder, or DID, and severe post-traumatic stress. Dr. Valley alleges respondent mistreatment of DK caused a setback in her care. In her response to the board, respondent stated the following, quote, regarding the consideration of professional boundaries, licensed therapists are bound by a different level of restriction than doctors are when it comes to friendships with patients, end quote. Respondent is the vice president of PsychANP, which is a psychiatric association of naturopathic physicians. According to the PsychANP member listing, respondent lists her percentage focus in mental health as 75% to 100% and her area focus as integrative and homeopathic medicine for bipolar disorder, PTSD, OCD, schizophrenia, mental health. PsychANP appears to be an association of physician conjoint for a price and does not appear to have a specialty certification associated with it. Respondent stated she began seeing DK as a patient beginning in January of 2017, initially treating her for mood instability, insomnia, and menopausal symptoms. She states DK began to show signs of dissociative disorder in the spring of 2017. In her 2023 email, respondent appears to admit she made mistakes regarding boundaries, where she states, quote, I can assure you that I do fully understand the main problem and where I went wrong in the last 2 years together. It appears during the course of treatment, DK participated in one or more podcasts with respondent. The podcast appears to have placed DK in stressful situations as noted in Respondent 713-2022 chart note addendum. March of 2021, it appears may have been paying DK possibly through a GoFundMe account. According to the oncology office notes from Dr. Huber, DK was diagnosed with breast cancer 12/9/2021, positive for estrogen receptor, positive for progesterone receptor. DK underwent a double mastectomy in April of 2022. Lab results show testosterone and progesterone levels even after the patient's breast cancer diagnosis.
Is the complainant present? Chelsea, Valerie?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Payman, can you give us a brief rundown on this complaint from your point of view? I've read your correspondence.
Yes, thank you. So I started working with this patient in January 2017, and I referred her to multiple therapists, especially once I saw that she needed more intensive therapy. I persistently referred her to additional practitioners to get the help that she needed. And this is referenced in the timeline of referrals and practitioners that she worked with, which was in the references and attachments document starting on page 2. And so this, I would like to speak to the hormone replacement therapy component briefly, which was not in the complaint, but I just wanted to speak to that first. So this patient was taking hormone replacement therapies when she first started to see me. She had already been on hormone replacement therapies from her previous naturopathic doctor, and she was on dosages that were quite high of estrogen and progesterone and testosterone. And I proceeded to, once I took over that aspect of her care, which was later in 2017, I started testing and reducing her levels. And what we found was that her psychiatric health was very much dependent on these hormone replacement therapies. And every time I tried to taper, especially estrogen, she would go into a state of psychiatric distress, which we would manage. And I was still very adamant about the fact that I wanted her on less of these hormone replacement therapies. I thought that was important for just being responsible as far as what she was taking, because I felt that she had been given doses that were not physiological doses. So I continued to taper her and manage the side effects or withdrawal effects of that taper. And it was determined, I believe it was the end of 2021, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. It was a very small, low-grade breast cancer, thankfully perfectly treatable, completely treatable with surgery only. She was working with a team of oncologists, a surgeon and a hematologist and a team of oncology specialists. And she was also, in the summer of 2022, she had started working with a gynecologist, Dr. Bert Webb, who all of these providers were meeting with her throughout that time before and during and after her breast cancer surgery, which I believe was in April 2022. And they came to the conclusion that it was medically necessary for her to remain on these hormone replacement therapies for the stability of her psychiatric health. She wasn't taking these for aesthetic purposes or even just for menopausal symptoms. She was reliant on them. And that's in the supplemental documentation that I provided to the board in the end of October. I included excerpts from the chart notes, the encounter notes from Dr. Abair and Dr. Webb that stated that that the patient understood the risks and benefits of remaining on these hormone replacement therapies, and that it was the patient's decision. She understood the pros and cons, the risks and benefits, and she understood that it was not the typical standard of care to remain on these hormone replacement therapies after a diagnosis of breast cancer. And yet the research in the most recent years has demonstrated that particularly bioidentical hormone replacement therapies are not contraindicated in cases of breast cancer survivors. And so the patient chose to remain on these hormone replacement therapies for her psychiatric stability. As far as the concern about whether my actions harmed my patient, firstly, I have not communicated with this patient since July of this year, and our last communication was very respectful. And she spoke about the fact that she was receiving the care that she needs. She didn't say that she was doing very well, but she said that she was, but her communication with me was very respectful and caring. And as far as how she's doing now, I first wanted to say that I can't comment on anything that I haven't had the opportunity to review. So I would need to see all of her records. I haven't seen any records of her care since 2022. So I need to see that in order to have an opportunity to comment on her current status. What I can say is that this patient is seriously, chronically mentally ill. She's been in some kind of distress since she was a small child. And she came to me in a state of deterioration and dysfunction, which I believe was the result of not receiving any mental health care treatment by her own choice for 12 years prior to starting work with me, which this state of deterioration and dysfunction was documented in the chart note from Dr. Lori Brower, who she was working with in December of 2016, where Dr. Brower noted that the patient was only sleeping about 2 hours a night. She felt like she had dementia. She was making serious mistakes at work. She wasn't able to work safely. She was missing work because of her brain fog and from her lack of sleep. She was already in a state of serious dysfunction before she started working with me. And she saw significant improvements in several areas as a result of our work together, which she spoke about publicly, and also it's documented in some of my encounter notes that I included some quotes from that in my supplemental documentation that I submitted in the end of October. She's also spoken about in some of the podcast interviews that she did about my work with her being quite beneficial, and also my personal relationship with her being healing in many ways to her. As far as the consideration of professional boundaries, yes, I developed a friendship with a patient. And there's nothing explicitly stating that a doctor is not allowed to develop a friendship with a patient. Even though my practice is focused in mental health, I still need to operate according to the rules of my own license rather than that of a therapist or a counselor. At the time that I accepted DK's invitation for a friendship, I didn't believe that I was overstepping any professional boundaries, because at the time, what I understood was that as I mentioned before, it wasn't against any specific explicit rule that a doctor was not allowed to have a friendship with a patient. And what was most essential was that the doctor is able to maintain good clinical judgment and good care for the patient, and that the doctor isn't abusing their position or of authority in any way, and also that there's no romantic element to the relationship. And so At the time, I did not believe that I was doing anything wrong. In hindsight and with perspective on this situation, I have come to regret the decision to say yes to her invitation for a friendship. And I see that I was overly involved in this patient's life. Once I became her friend and I started to see how many needs she had, I just kept showing up for her and saying, how can I help you? What do you need? And I just kept showing up in that way again and again and accepting, saying, yes, okay, yes, I can help you. Yes, I can do that too. And it became almost like a mission for me to help her. I cared deeply about her, and there's nothing wrong with caring deeply, but I do believe that I became overly involved in her life, and I understand that, and I can see that now. I didn't see it then, but I do see this now. And I recently completed a 6-hour continuing education seminar about professional boundaries, and I included the CE certificate towards the end of the references and attachments document that I shared with the board in the end of October. And that additional education has helped me to broaden my understanding of what professional boundaries really means. That I thought that I understood it, but it's clear to me that despite my development of expertise in the treatment of serious mental illness from a clinical perspective, I needed more education about all of the specific nuances and really the more of the underlying principles of what professional boundaries really entails. So I'm owning my mistakes, and I can absolutely assure the board that this was an isolated situation. It has never happened before. I've never had a friendship with a patient before, and I will never have a friendship with a patient in the future. I'm fully committed to doing the right thing here and acknowledging that I'm not perfect. I'm learning from the past so that I can move forward with greater wisdom. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. And I do have my attorney on the call as well, and he can assist.
And Dr. Bayman, who's your attorney?
Bruce Smith.
Bruce Smith, okay. I have a couple questions for you. With your patients, since you state you're doing basic sort of a psychotherapeutic / medical practice with them, are you using and are you coding with both the medical codes in the DSM-5 codes? Because as you know, there's codes for mental health, and then there's also medical codes that we use.
Yeah, so it depends on the case. And I am coding, if it's a psychiatric case, then I'll use DSM-5 codes in documenting that diagnosis.
Okay. And what you're in is an association. It's not a board certification in either psychotherapy or a counseling role. It's basically an association type role, correct?
Yeah, the Psychiatric Association of Naturopathic Physicians is a small, well, it started in 2016 as a small nonprofit organization. And I was one of the founding members of that organization. And we're, now it's grown to about 300 members. As an organization, just launched the application process for board certification, or for certification. We're not calling it board certification, but for certification to become a fellow of the American Board of naturopathic psychiatry. So I don't have that certification yet because it hasn't existed yet. But I do have additional certification as a certified clinical trauma professional, which was an additional certification that I received, I believe in 2019. And I have close to 350 hours of continuing education, specifically in psychiatry and psychology, as well as about 119 hours of self-study, specifically in the field of trauma and dissociation.
Are any of those certifications noted by the health board, i.e. the Board of Behavioral Health, or are they just more self-study?
They're for self-study. They're just for, increasing competency and education in the field of psychology.
Okay. And do you have professionals such as social workers, LCSWs, psychologists, psychiatry? Do you have a referral basis for patients? And when do you triage a patient out to see a professional?
I have a large network of therapists, psychiatrists, psychologists, and other medical and mental health professionals that I refer to on a very regular basis. I've grown that network simply by engaging with them over the past 16 years of my practice. And it's a clinical judgment in every case based on the patient's needs. So I refer for counseling almost in every case, unless it's just not warranted. But most of my patients are mental health patients, and most of my patients would benefit more. Their health would improve more if they had the additional pillar of support of counseling in some capacity. So yes, so I refer usually very early in the process, after the initial consultation or during that initial consultation, I'll talk to them about additional resources or referrals that I feel would be appropriate or helpful or necessary. In some cases, I had a recent case where I told the patient that I would refuse to continue working with her if she didn't receive counseling in addition. And she was telling me that she didn't want to go to counseling, and I thought that she needed very intensive counseling. And so I set that boundary with her that I wouldn't be continuing as her doctor if she refused to receive that care. And she understood, and she did choose to move forward with that. And that ended up being beneficial for her.
So you're not doing our psychotherapeutic consults. You're basically referring those patients out to a licensed professional.
Yes.
Okay. I have a couple quick questions on your labs, then I need to have put my board members in there, and then get Ms. Valerie to come in too. On your labs, the thyroid labs particularly, some of those, basically she was probably over-medicated.
Mm-hmm.
What was your thought process, and where was your clinical thoughts on that?
Regarding the thyroid labs?
Correct. Cortisol lab.
The thyroid and cortisol?
Correct.
So with regard to the thyroid, that was also something that had been managed by her previous naturopathic doctor. And so I would test it. She was, I don't recall at the moment, I think she had been taking Armour thyroid or something along those lines. Maybe that's not true. I know that previously she had been on that, and she was on quite a high dose. I think she had been on 60 milligrams, and then it was doubled, and her thyroid levels were quite high. Anytime that I saw that there was a lab level that was out of balance, particularly in the beginning of my care with her, I would talk with her about it. And then I would, you know, with regard to the thyroid, there were a few times that was out of balance. And so I adjusted. I think that she had been on 10 micrograms of liothyronine T3, and I tapered it down to 5. And then her thyroid stayed fairly stable most of the, like, over the years. That became a non-issue most of the time, thankfully, compared with her other hormone therapies, which were very up and down. One of the things that I did speak to in my supplemental documentation regarding estrogen in particular was that, first of all, it appears that estrogen has a protective effect in the brain. And there's some research that I find pretty fascinating about estrogen being protective in PTSD, and that when estrogen levels are higher, that there's less of a negative impact of the trauma on the brain and the person sort of biologically, physiologically. So one of the things that we noticed was that it seems that in her case, and I haven't seen this in other cases, so I can't say that there's any kind of pattern here, but we did see it as a pattern for this patient in particular, that her estrogen levels would go up and down in response to trauma memories that were coming up. And so one of the things that we started to do was if we would run labs, rather than saying, you know, if her estrogen was high or low, rather than assuming, we finally got to a point where rather than assuming, oh, we need to change your dosage, we actually started to just pause and say, well, what else is going on? Are you also experiencing a trauma memory, you know, that's surging right now? And we need to have you focus on stabilizing your nervous system more. And then we would retest, and her estrogen would often, sometimes it would have calmed down a little bit or normalized a little bit. If it didn't, then we would adjust her dosage. Regarding her cortisol levels, her PM cortisol was high several times. On testing, she would go in to get blood testing towards the end of the day, like 5 p.m., and her cortisol levels were high several times. And that was, from my perspective, my thinking about that was cortisol is a stress hormone. She was under a tremendous amount of stress from a variety of, you know, internal and external sources. And that was a trauma-related physiological response in her body. One thing that is interesting, which I didn't write this in my supplemental documentation, but just anecdotally, when she first came to work with me, she had previously taken supplements, natural supplements like L-theanine, as an example, which helps to lower cortisol. She reported to me that she would take that, and also things like a product called Gabacom. She used the words, she would take them like candy, and it wouldn't do anything for her. She didn't feel it at all. And then after we had worked together for several years, her nervous system started to calm down enough that she was actually able to feel the effect of these supplements. So she could actually take a couple of capsules of theanine and feel like, okay, I can feel it working. Whereas before, her levels were so high that she couldn't even, and she was probably also very disconnected and dissociated from her body to even be able to sense how stressed she was. She also started to need to use an alarm clock to wake up in the morning, instead of waking up out of a fear response every morning way too early. She was starting to actually be able to sleep longer, which is another indicator of physiological normalization of those stress hormones.
All right. And Dr. Perryman, I need to roll through with the rest of my board members. I need to get talk to Ms. Valerie. But Dr. Rubin, can I roll on to you for questions?
Yes. Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Sadalek. Hi, Dr. Payman. This is Dr. Dan Rubin. Were you following her for her diagnosis of breast cancer?
I was not involved in that treatment whatsoever.
Okay. Were you in contact with her? Well, were you in contact with her oncology team when you decided to prescribe the estrogen for her post-diagnosis?
I wasn't in direct contact with them initially. What I was relying on was reports from the patient and what the patient was telling me that happened in those meetings. So the patient was in close contact with me and telling me this is how this appointment went. This is what the doctor said. This is what they're going to do. There was one conversation that I had with the patient in May of 2022 where the patient was reporting to me that the patient was in a lot of distress that day and was reporting to me that her doctors didn't want her to stay on these hormone therapies, and she felt that she was adamant that they were absolutely essential for her life. Like, she felt like it was an absolutely emergency life and death decision that she needed to stay on these, because without them she would deteriorate so quickly. And she told me that her doctors didn't understand that, and they wanted her off these things. And it turned out, once I received the records from her doctors later in that year, that that wasn't actually true, that her oncologist did understand and noted that, although of course she would prefer for her to be off of the hormone therapies or to at least taper, that it may not be possible because of her mental health condition.
Understood. Thank you. You are no longer her treating physician, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Since you're not writing prescriptions for her, do you know if she still has somebody? Is she still followed by oncology or gynecology or somebody who's providing prescriptions, or do you just not have contact with?
I don't have contact with any of her doctors or prescribers currently, so I can't confirm anything along those lines. The last I knew, what I did do was I pulled her pharmacy board records so that I could have that for my own record of what the pharmacy board had, you know, shown that I prescribed and that other providers had prescribed as far as her controlled substances. And it showed that she was receiving testosterone prescriptions from Dr. Anna Wolin, who is a doctor that I referred CK to in the end of 2022. And I'm not sure if she's continuing to work with her, but Dr. Ebert stated, who was her oncologist, stated in her encounter note, I believe it was from the summer of 2022, it stated that she was planning to see her in 6 months. And so I don't know if it's going to be, you know, every 6 months or annually after that. But I felt like she was very well cared for in that regard.
Got it. The complainant in this case, who I know we haven't heard from, is the complainant a physician?
No. She's a licensed social worker.
And according to your affidavit or your testimony that we read, you stated it, and I don't have the law or anything, but you said there are different rules for psychologists, which I'm guessing PhD level, and counselors, in terms of friendship with patients, that are different than psychiatrists or physicians that are treating people for mental health. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah. The rules for a therapist or a psychologist are stricter. They're not allowed to have a friendship with their patients or their clients at all. And whereas with a doctor, a licensed doctor, whether that's a naturopathic doctor or a MD, and psychiatrists are MDs, so they would fall into this category, that it's that they're not explicitly prohibited from having a friendship with a patient. There are stipulations and boundaries that still need to be maintained, and certain, there are organizations that make their own rules about that, but as far as the actual license goes, it's different for counselors or therapists versus doctors.
Thank you. Do you agree with the diagnosis of DID and PTSD for this patient?
Yes, I absolutely do.
Okay, and you were operating under those. In your opinion, did your care of this patient or your friendship cause setbacks in her movement towards improved health or improved wellness or improved symptoms?
I do not believe that my care of this patient caused setbacks. And I have a lot of documentation that shows that my care of her actually provided a lot of benefit to her.
Meaning the opposite of what the complainant said.
Yes.
Why do you think the complainant complained about this in that way?
I think that, well, as I stated in the beginning of my remarks, as far as the status of this patient, first of all, I haven't seen the records, so I don't know exactly what's happening with this patient at this time. I do know that she is very mentally unwell, and that she often perseverates over things that happened to her and didn't go the way that she had hoped, or that that were difficult for her. And so I think it's, she may be going through something that's really difficult for her, and I don't doubt that she's in distress, and she may be having some complaints about the way that, you know, so we had this friendship. It wasn't able to be sustained because of the way that the patient was excessively relying on me, and because of the way that the patient was treating me. It wasn't a sustainable relationship. I thought that it could be. I believed in her a lot, and I believed that we would be able to overcome any challenges because of what I had seen and witnessed in our work together. I thought that it would be possible, and it turned out that it just wasn't possible. And so the friendship wasn't sustainable. And so I don't know. But I have a feeling that it is possibly related to that.
Got it. And my last question is, do you think that you made a mistake, an error medically? Do you think you, and here's another part, do you think you made a mistake or error in judgment regarding the wholeness of how you, not the wholeness, but various parts or none of how you handled things when you were her physician? And the last part of that question, the third part, which I'm trying to formulate in my head, is if there was an error or a mistake, or a misjudgment, what were those? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll try to remember each of those things individually. So in my medical care for her, I do not feel that I made an error. Of course, there may have been things that I wish I would have known. You know, I, for example, prescribed her sertraline at one point, and she didn't like that medication and didn't respond well. Okay. You know what I mean? I wouldn't say that's an error. There were things that I may have done differently if I had known what was going to happen, but I wouldn't call those errors. I don't feel that I made any significant errors of any kind or mistakes in her medical care. Can you repeat the second part? I want to make sure I get that one. Or did that answer the second part as well? Dr. Rubin?
Dr. Rubin, are you still there?
Can you hear me? Yeah, sorry. I don't know what happened. I think it was me not pressing mute, and I was talking the whole time. Sorry about that, you guys. This is Ruben. I was looking to see if you thought that you had a medical mistake or error, and you said no. We know in your testimony looking back that you think that maybe there was some misjudgments or
yeah.
boundaries. But from what I've heard, it doesn't seem, in your opinion, to have negatively affected her care. And so I'm wondering why you think that you misjudged your, and the friendship may have not, maybe there was a boundary issue. Was it a boundary issue that didn't, so let me ask the question. Do you think that there was a boundary issue, even though according to your testimony as a physician, there are different rules for becoming friends with patients? Do you think it was a boundary issue that you were uncomfortable with as a physician, but it didn't affect her care, or was there something else that you mean?
I think it was probably that it was a boundary issue that so what I realized in looking back at this situation was that I had a gut feeling from the very beginning when she invited me to this event in Flagstaff. That was the first sort of social event that we both attended together. It was like with some of her acquaintances, and she invited me to go to, and that was with the camping, involved a camping trip. There was only one camping trip, just to correct the record. There were no church events as well. We never attended any church events together. I had a gut feeling at that time that I should not go. And I didn't really listen to that gut feeling. And that was a mistake. I should have just said no.
Got it. So this is your, it sounds like your first exploration of friendship with a patient. And you had no experience with that in the past. And
correct.
It sounds like you've learned certain things. And I guess it's, you know, I'm a licensed physician, like many of us on the board. And occasionally it sounds like some doctors come in contact with people who they would otherwise be friends with had they not been their patient, and maybe they'd come in contact with them somewhere else and there wouldn't have been a doctor-patient relationship, but still the same person. Is that what you think kind of happened here, but just was interesting how you came to, or different how you came to know this patient and came to meet them?
I do feel that way. I think that because after we started engaging in conversations, you know, small talk kind of conversations, maybe at the end of an appointment, it became clear that we shared very similar values, that we both were really interested in meditation and mindfulness and kind of like outdoorsy hiking and things like that. And so, yeah, I do feel that we probably would have been friends outside of the professional relationship, you know, had we met somewhere else. And yeah.
Thank you. Got it. Thank you, Dr. Payman, and thank you, Dr. Fedelec. I've completed my questions.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Rubin. Dr. Spatt, I need to keep moving through the list, and we still need to hear from Chelsea Valerie. So go ahead.
There, just a spot. I don't have anything to ask at the moment. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Campbell, this is kind of right up your alley, so I'm going to move up to you.
Thank you. Dr. Payman, good afternoon to you. With regard to when, in 2017, when you initially began seeing the patient had presented to you indicating that there had been a 12-year absence in mental health care and that she had a diagnosis. and you began treating her with that. Well, at that time, was she on any type of mental health medications?
No, I don't believe that she was. She had a previous prescription for Advil, which she had used occasionally for panic attacks or insomnia, but I don't believe that she was taking any mental health medications at that time. She had no mental health care at all. So, and she had a primary care doctor or nurse practitioner or PA, something like that, that she had established care with, but that provider wasn't giving her any prescriptions for her mental health.
And were you able to check a PMP back then? Did you put a copy of a PMP in your record?
I don't believe that I did at that time. I don't know no, I'm sorry. I don't believe I did that.
And so with regard to the two diagnoses that are indicated, how did we come up with those? Did she share those with you as prior diagnoses, or are those diagnoses that you came up with her together?
She shared with me that she had previously been diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder and complex PTSD, and she thought at the time that the DID had resolved. That was her belief, because she wasn't, I believe it was because she was so dissociated from what she uses the term dissociated from the dissociation. She wasn't aware that it was very much still happening within her. And that was the reason that she thought that she had dementia, because she was having memory lapses. She was disoriented. She was losing her way on hiking trails that she had done 1,000 times. She was experiencing very severe dissociation at work, and even when driving, she was crashing her car multiple times because she would dissociate into a younger alter who didn't know how to drive quite as well. And so this was the state she was in when she came to me. And she also was presenting with a lot of symptoms of bipolar disorder. She had symptoms of mania and a lot of depression. The mania wasn't really none of it looked typical though. And so I had an initial sort of working diagnosis of possible bipolar. I thought perhaps she had borderline personality disorder, which truly BPD is on the spectrum of dissociative disorders. It just was much more severe than she was kind of demonstrating or had awareness of. And so she wasn't aware of her dissociative parts. And so she wasn't, at the time, she wasn't telling me that that was happening. Those dissociative episodes were happening. And so it wasn't something that I diagnosed her with until I witnessed it with my own eyes in my office. And then it became completely obvious that it was a current diagnosis.
Do you use any of the established testing or scoring sheets with regard to coming up with your mental health diagnoses?
Sometimes I do. I usually use the DSM-5 and a clinical interview much more often than a sort of a screening questionnaire or scoring.
How about in this case?
I used the DSM-5 in my clinical interview rather than a scoring kind of questionnaire.
I see. And earlier you indicated that you regularly refer patients to analysts, whether it be master level therapists or beyond. In this particular case, you mentioned that you had a patient that was seriously and chronically mentally ill. At any point along the way, did you make any written referrals for this patient to go and be analyzed by a mental health provider?
I referred her I did write referral letters as well as make many phone calls and gave the patient information as well as contacting the provider specifically. I referred her to over 10 therapists, I believe, psychologists or therapists or counselors over the course of my work with her. I referred her to psychiatrists, psychiatric nurse practitioners, and other medical providers as well. And all of that is documented in the referrals and the healthcare practitioner's timeline, which is in the references and attachments document starting on page 2.
Okay. And what came of that?
It was very complicated. Do you have a more specific question? Or I could...
Simply, did she see anybody at any point? And then as a result of that, did you receive notes back that clarified your diagnosis and made any recommendations? And if so, maybe you could outline the more significant of those recommendations.
So in the very beginning of my work with her, when in March 2017, when I started to witness the dissociative episodes in my office, I had a conversation with her about her level of severity of her mental illness and told her that I needed to refer her for more help than what I was able to provide on my own. And I referred her to, let me pull up my notes on the referrals list. So I referred her to Sharon Chambers, who's a licensed professional counselor, in March of 2017. Sharon subsequently recommended an IOP, an intensive outpatient program, for this patient because of the severity of her symptoms. And so I referred her to an intensive outpatient program. She did go to that, and that was for a period of about 6 months.
Okay, yeah, I see that.
There were a lot of different providers that this person worked with, that I referred her to, that she worked with. The problems were that she would often go to these providers, and then either the patient would have a problem with the provider, stating something along the lines of, they're not really very attentive, they don't understand, I can't connect with them, or the provider would say, I can't work with you.
Okay.
Either it's too intense, or I don't like, there was one therapist, psychologist who's an expert in DID and complex PTSD. I was very excited for this patient to work with her. This was in 2021. Her name is Sandrine, and the patient was scheduled to start with Sandrine. They had a phone conversation about the beginning of their work together or something it was something about, the patient was requesting longer appointments, I believe, like a 90-minute session instead of 60 minutes, or perhaps twice a week instead of once a week. I don't remember the exact request. I wasn't present for the phone call. It was the phone call the patient had with this psychologist, and the patient told me about it afterwards.
I see. If I can interrupt just so we can move on in the interest of brevity, I also, I guess one of my concerns is, at some point when our patients' needs seem to rise to the level where they may exceed our expertise, our ability to care, completely for that patient, and we need to simply, for their good, refer them to, say, a psychiatrist, especially when they start having medical issues that bring in pharmaceuticals along with the mental health issues and whatnot, that we're doing that. At any time, did you feel that that may have been prudent, or in hindsight, do you think that that may have been a better call for the situation, is to refer the patient to a psychiatrist?
to refer them and completely, meaning like I wasn't going to be working with her at all.
Either way.
I referred her to psychiatrists many times. And it didn't work out. She refused to continue to work with them, or they refused to work with her.
Okay, now this podcast thing.
Yes.
What was this something that you brought her in on, or vice versa,
no.
Or
vice versa? So the podcast was hers.
I see. Okay.
The podcast was her idea. She had an acquaintance, Alicia, who was a podcaster professionally. They created the podcast. The patient requested that I be present and be present during the podcast recording. So it was the patient's podcast. It wasn't mine.
And what did you do on your end to ensure that you were maintaining HIPAA compliance?
The patient decided to go public with her story on her own. She came to her own decision that she wanted to profess to the public, this is my diagnosis, this is my name, this is my diagnosis, I am publicly announcing it,
I
want everybody to know. So I wasn't, you know.
Did you have her sign a release form?
She did sign a consent form, yes.
And that was put into the record?
She signed a consent form with the podcaster, actually.
So not with you?
Not with me.
I see. Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, that's all I have at this moment. And I'll wait to hear from the patient. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Dr. Profio, can I move on to you? Then I'll go on to Ms. Gella, and then I'd like to wrap with Ms. Valerie.
Sure. Most of my questions have been answered. I just have a couple specifically related to the actual hormone replacement. So Dr. Payman, I believe you stated that the patient came in on 7 milligrams of oral estradiol and well over 1,000 milligrams of progesterone. What was the thought process? I know that was not your prescription, but do you know why that those type of doses were ever used?
What the patient told me, and actually also spoke with the prescriber, the doctor who had prescribed those doses, about that, because I had the same question. And what they said was that she was started on more normal doses, and then her symptoms she would get better, and then she would get worse. And so the doctor would raise the dose, and that just kept happening. And her dosage just kept going up and up and up and up and up. Instead of, like I said before, where when I saw her levels or her symptoms changing, I would pause and say, well, what else is going on here? What do we need to look at? Maybe we don't need to give you more. Sometimes we needed to for her safety if her levels were very low and she was very suicidal, for example, then sometimes I needed to go up temporarily, and then we would come back down. But that was the thinking, as far as I understand, from the previous doctor.
And I believe you mentioned, you know, trying to change her to a topical, I believe, estradiol combo. What were the doses you were looking to achieve on the hormones as you move forward?
The dosages as far as like milligrams of estradiol, milligrams.
Yeah,
of
I'm just curious what you were shooting for.
And I
apologize, let me just add one more part of that. After she had the breast cancer, what kind of doses of medication were you using?
So I was hoping to get her levels closer to 2 milligrams or less, you know, 2.5 or less. Her levels got down into that range of 2.5 milligrams or close to 2 milligrams of estradiol and 2.5 milligrams of estriol. And then her progesterone, I was able to get down from 1,000 milligrams down to, I believe, 200 milligrams at the end. Or 300? I think it was 300 at the end. So more normal.
Right.
Yeah. And then as far as her the breast cancer diagnosis, at that point I had really tried to refer her on. It ended up being that she wouldn't stay with anybody, or nobody would stay with her. I couldn't get solid on a new doctor that she could stay with regarding her hormone therapies. So that was a thing that I ended up continuing to provide refills on throughout 2022. But I had referred her to a naturopathic doctor in March of 2022, Dr. Madeline Schaeferman, who was focused on gut health and also had experience with hormones. And I was hoping that she could take over that. And then she was working with Dr. Bert Webb, who's a gynecologist who had taken over her hormone therapies for a short period of time. And then the patient had a conflict with him. So she chose not to continue working with him. And then her hormone therapies were taken over by Dr. Anna Wolin at the end of 2022. So I really wasn't doing much in the way of changing her levels. I was really just trying to step back and provide as much stability as possible for her psychiatric health. And it seemed like the best thing to do was to just, if her levels were high on testing, lower it a little bit incrementally, but no huge changes, because that would always create too much distress and dysfunction for her.
Okay. I saw some fairly elevated ferritin levels, and I was curious if there was any thoughts on why that was happening. In my practice, I've seen that happen, obviously, if somebody has hemochromatosis, but more so in people who are drinking heavily. Mm-hmm. Did this patient consume alcohol in any way that might explain those ferritin levels?
No, she didn't consume alcohol in an unhealthy way whatsoever. I have seen ferritin levels as a marker of inflammation. So my guess is that it's possible that it could have been related to inflammation in her body. I don't know any other reason that her ferritin would have been high. Although the only other reason could have been if her iron was high at the same time. She did have anemia that was also treated. It was macrocytic anemia that was treated with B12 supplementation. And then occasionally she was working with Dr. Curley, her hematologist, before the breast cancer diagnosis for the anemia. And he had done an iron infusion for her at one point. She had done that through him. So it's a possibility that she got a little too much iron at one point, and that's why her ferritin was high. But I suspect it might have been a marker of inflammation.
Okay, I appreciate it. All right, Dr. Sadalek, that's all I had to add today.
Thank you, Dr. Popio. Ms. Gallen, comments, suggestions, questions for Dr. Payman? Ms. Gallen, still there?
Yes, I don't have any questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. And if I could, and I appreciate it if you're still holding on, Chelsea Bellery, are you still with us?
I'm here. Hi. Okay.
Thanks for hanging with us. Can you go ahead and give us kind of a 5-minute rundown?
Oh boy. Okay. Yes. 5-minute rundown. So, DK has the most complicated trauma history, one of the most complicated trauma histories that I've ever encountered. And I am an LCSW that specializes in trauma related disorders, mainly dissociative disorders and DID. I'm perplexed at the focus, and I don't want to dismiss naturopathic work at all, but I'm perplexed on the focus on hormone therapy when this woman started seeking care and has presented with dissociative identity disorder symptoms for 30 plus years since her children were older with the previous diagnosis, and that practitioner continue to treat DID without any additional training specific to DID. You can get trained in PTSD modalities all you want, but that does not mean you specialize in dissociative disorders, especially dissociative identity disorder, because it's a very complex presentation in many people. My biggest concern is not the medical aspect, but the counseling that took place that then turned into cross of boundaries. The client has told me that she fought the friendship for a long time because it didn't feel okay. But there are many alters within her that were developed during horrific physical, sexual, and torturous trauma that have a very confusing perspective on who people are in her life and the complexities of attachment, especially secure attachment, because she was raised by abusers on all ends, from all sides of the family. When boundaries were crossed, I have a list of things that the doctor and client did together. They went to a yoga class together. They went to meditation together. Both had been to each other's homes before. After the client had breast surgery, the doctor went there and helped unwrap and rewrap her. The doctor invited DK to church, but then uninvited her because the doctor's husband was really uncomfortable with the relationship because he felt that it was inappropriate. My client now sees this relationship as an emotional affair because of the depths of the spiritual and emotional things that her and the doctor shared with one another. That level of vulnerability with a client with such complex trauma is absolute recipe for disaster. I now have a woman in her 60s who is convinced, younger alters within her system are convinced that this doctor is going to come rescue her, because that's what the doctor practiced in their therapy sessions, rescuing a 60-some-year-old woman from the basement of where a trauma happened when she was 4 years old. The psychotherapy practices were absolutely wrong and unethical and caused further fragmentation within her psyche. And I have spent months upon months working with this client to time orient her, to get to know her dissociative system, to gain trust within the system, because she has not only a lack of trust for majority of people in the world, but now practitioners, because from her perspective, and while there were good things that happened, and she admits that throughout their care, she has spent all of her retirement on therapy with Dr. Payman, and feels almost more broken than ever, with virtually no support and not a lot of hope for the future until she joined our intensive outpatient program. But that will come to an end at some point, and she is moving into, honestly, a healthy level of anger based on the way that medical care ended. And I could keep going. So I don't know. There may be specific questions would be helpful.
When you were seeing the patient, was there a time when you thought the patient would benefit from psychiatry and seeing a psychiatrist for medication evaluation?
Yes, she is right now.
Okay. So she's doing that currently.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much, you know, the board knows about dissociative identity disorder, but there's no pharmacological treatment for DID, but there is pharmacological support for certain symptoms of DID, you know, such as anxiety or depression.
Okay. And Dr. Campbell, do you want to add anything?
No, other than to thank her for the work that she's doing with this patient and helping resolve the situation and get her the help that she needs. We appreciate that for sure. It definitely helps us have a more important understanding of the things that occurred, more so than just simply reading a piece of paper and understanding whether or not one practitioner may have the training and experience they need to appropriately care for a patient's mental health. So we appreciate her coming today.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Board members, any questions for Ms. Valerie while we have her?
This is Dr. Rubin. I mirror the comments. Thank you for bringing this to our attention and agreed the work that you're doing. I wanted to have questions for you, but I don't, only because I think you answered anything I was going to ask. So thank you.
Yeah.
And Dr. Popiel, any comments?
I don't have any additional questions right now.
Okay. Ms. Gallen, Dr. Spatt.
I don't have anything either.
Okay.
This is Dr. Spatt. Chelsea, I'm just curious. So is DK doing okay? I'm just curious.
Yeah, so she's okay. She, working with such a fragmented adult who has numerous, three adult alters who kind of take the load of day-to-day living and multiple younger alters that hold the most horrific trauma you can imagine. I don't know if a person is ever truly okay, but she is stable enough and she's extremely active in our program and she really is learning about her dissociative system and learning to advocate for the wrongs that have been done to her throughout her entire life. And trust is one of the biggest things for her. And I work with, my specialty is dissociative disorders, aka trauma. So
how often do the DK seeing you at the moment? Now I'm just from my learning experience.
Yeah, so she attends group therapy with us 5 days a week. And and then I see her twice a week for individual therapy. And she's starting to see our somatic experiencing therapist as well.
Oh, okay, thank you. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Spatt. Board members, any further questions? Because I'd like to try to move along. We have a heavy agenda. No.
Okay. Nothing for me, unless Ms. Valerie has anything else she wanted to conclude with. Then
I just want to say one thing, and I'll let you guys move on. But I understand the push and pull that we get with highly traumatized clients. I receive it all the time, the wanting to attach too much, the wanting to push me away. It's a consistent pattern when working with attachment-based wounds, and it takes a very educated, skilled person who has received hours upon hours upon hours of training and supervision to work with this population. And my biggest concern is that the doctor did not have any of that. And walking in blindly with a case like this is absolute recipe for disaster for the practitioner and the client. And I think we've seen that.
Thank you.
Board members, we have a couple options, so let's address those. One of the options is we could draft up a letter of, draft up a consent agreement and state the issues we have, or we can move this to formal, which would bring us back into this in December. I think we've gotten a pretty good feel as to the case and possibly some resolution. So can we bring that to discussion at this time? or do you want to?
Would you mind giving us a sense of what you're thinking between whether probation, CEUs, et cetera? What would be your first inclination here?
Due to the complexity of it, we're dealing with the, in my mind, Dr. Papillo, and please, you know, feel free to add, we're dealing with the endocrinology aspect. We're also dealing with the psychological aspect, boundary aspect. So we're dealing with so many different parts of this case that I think you could either do a, I don't know if we can do a letter of concern with attachments for, I have some CME definitely in mind, or we'd have to move to a consent agreement with a letter of reprimand with the CMEs attached.
This is Dr. Rubin. I think a lot has come up with this. I think it was great that it was brought to our attention. I do trust in our specialty organizations, and I was considering not a letter of reprimand, but more of a consent agreement for some CE. I'm specifically thinking about doctor-patient relationship. I know respondent Dr. Payne was talking about being excited about a particular lecture she was going to attend, but I think formal CEs would be good. And I was thinking maybe 4 hours because I think we have a class for that. But I was hopeful that there would be some specific education in the world of DIDs. So I don't have any expertise whatsoever. I'm an oncologist, and so it sounds to me like there's mega intricacies and that this is a subspecialty in itself, and that I just don't know because I don't work in that field. In terms of the oncology part, it's not really what's at hand. She's being cared for. I know the physicians that both Hebert, or I think it was Laura Hebert, Bert Webb, Brendan Curley, these are all licensed practitioners that are in my world all the time. And so, and guessing she's still seeing those doctors, you know, the estrogen time has come and gone. We don't have those records before us. And so I don't know that for me enters into this. I think this is about what the complaint was. And that's where I stand.
Okay. All right.
And Dr. Rubin and Dr. Sadlick, just so we sort of get oriented a little bit as far as like possibilities. So if the board is inclined to issue, the board can do a can issue a non-disciplinary order for CME at this point. It can join that with a letter of concern if the board feels that is appropriate. The board can issue those two things together or separate. If the board is looking for a disciplinary option, it would be to offer a consent agreement because the board can't issue discipline at this point. Offer a consent agreement for a probationary period during which time Dr. Payman would have to complete the CME the board determines to be appropriate.
Dr. Rubin, which way were you leaning?
I was leaning towards a motion of letter of concern with a non-disciplinary order for continuing education regarding doctor-patient relationship boundaries and DID.
Okay. And basically try to get that drafted up as a consent agreement that would be she'd have 30 days to sign it.
Dr. Sadlick, at this point, because those both are non-disciplinary, the board can just issue those at this meeting. But the board would need to specify what the concern to be expressed in the letter of concern is, as well as what CME is to be completed and when, and whether it's to be included in the hours required for renewal.
I move to issue a letter of concern regarding doctor-patient relationship boundaries, especially as in regard to patients with dissociative identity disorder, and specifically in this case, obviously, with a non-disciplinary order for 4 hours of CME, specifically in regard to doctor-patient relationships and boundaries, and 8 hours, in parentheses, hopeful that we can find this, regarding dissociative identity disorders and or closely related issues, if those happen to be commingled.
Okay. So, Dr. Rubin, let me just repeat it to make sure that I got it right. Your motion is for a letter of concern for boundary issues, especially with regard to a patient with dissociative identity disorder, and further to issue a non-disciplinary order for continuing medical education 4 hours in boundaries and 8 hours in dissociative identity disorder or related psychological issues.
Correct. And I am okay with the 4 hours doctor-patient relationship being included as part of the annual requirement, but not the 8 hours. The 8 hours of specialty would be on top of the usual.
Okay.
So moved.
Dr. Rubin, there is a course that's offered by PBI Education, and it's the course is entitled Ethics, Professionalism, and Patient Boundaries. It's been out there for a while. We've used this course for prior issues with boundaries with patients. It's a little bit more length of a course, but it's kind of tried and proven. Do you mind having the Dr. Payman take that particular course?
And Dr. Sadlick, just for my clarification, are you talking about the 3-day PBI course?
Yes.
Dr. Salek, I'm sorry, this is Gail. That the course you're referring to is typically the 14-hour course.
14 hours of CME course, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, and you can specifically require that PBI course, too, if you want to.
The motion has not been seconded. I think it's up for discussion. We'll see what the other board members think. Perhaps this is Ruben.
This is Clinton Campbell. If I may, is there some way that we can also work in that, you know, when we talk about, you know, DID and some other things, you know, that comes following a bunch of you know, a lot of mental health training and licensing and certification, and then you start to subspecialize in these different things. And I think what's important here, and when we refer back to the counselor's testimony of certain things that this physician was working with the patient on during their time together, being in her professional opinion inappropriate or leading to causing some of the issues that the patient is dealing with today. I would like to, you know, and I'm just going to put it as simple as possible, is that we have a licensed naturopathic physician that's trained in all of those modalities, and that's what she needs to be focused on. If she's going to be working with people in the mental health realm, that's fine, but the crux of the work needs to be accomplished by a licensed mental health practitioner. And then if she wants to, you know, piggyback onto that with her specialization and collaboration and, you know, prescribing an appropriate medication or whatever the case may be, you know, so I just want something from the board to clearly outline that she needs to maintain those boundaries with regard to the things that she's doing with patients who come seeking mental health care. And that if she's, you know, she's not completely trained and licensed to be, you know, their counseling patients in a traditional sense, that, you know, that she's very careful not to cross those boundaries, because we've, you know, obviously seen that it's caused a problem. And so, however we can accomplish that, I think would be important.
So, Dr. Campbell, would you suggest then, obviously, some form of the PBI course, and then additionally having, in this case, Dr. Payman, give the patient, have the patient sign and acknowledge that she is not a licensed healthcare provider, such as Chelsea Valerie is, and that the patient will most likely be referred to such a provider. Is that where you're going with this?
That's going to be, I mean, the only way to do conduct over time is through a probationary agreement, which is not what the board is contemplating at this point. To sort of fit the concerns in with what the board has been talking about, I mean, that would be, the board right now, the motion include 8 hours in continuing medical education in dissociative identity disorders or related psychological issues. I don't know if there's a course out there on managing, something more general about managing patients with psychological issues. I don't know.
I see. And with regard to earlier, you mentioned that there was a second letter a letter of concern that goes a non-disciplinary letter of concern or censure. Is that something that we could basically add in there is to stay within your training, your licensed mm-hmm. training?
So the board can issue non-disciplinary actions at today's meeting, and one of the board's choices is a letter of concern. The other one is a non-disciplinary order for CME. Some boards couple those so that they issue a letter of concern with a non-disciplinary order for CME. This board could certainly do that as well.
Yeah, I mean, that way we can definitely get the point across, and I think it would be outlined in one while we're requiring the training in the other. So, do you kind of get my training of thought with regard to what I'd like to accomplish with that letter? And having, her maintain, her specialization and licensed skills, and when those are being crossed, she needs to, refer a patient.
So right now the letter of concern was for boundary issues, especially with regard to patients with dissociative identity disorder. We could include something about ensuring and also that the concern was the doctor did not make the referrals when appropriate and did not make the appropriate referrals and continued to treat a patient whose illness was beyond her competency.
Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is Gail, and Dr. Valeri has raised her hand. Dr. Sadlick, did you want to let her speak?
Yeah, but I want to hold her for just a moment while I try to get this letter of concern drafted up. If the board doesn't mind, I'd like to try to get the majority of this done and then move on to Chelsea Valerie at the very end.
She may have a point of order with regard to what we're directly with this topic.
Okay.
And if Ms. Valeri, if you do have something regarding this topic that you'd like to discuss, go ahead. Otherwise, we'll hold off until the end, please.
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to make it really quick. I I felt rushed to kind of get my point across, but my biggest concern is that the doctor practiced outside of her scope for 5 years, creating further fragmentation and confusion within a seriously mentally ill client who has 15 plus different alters internally inside of her mind. I have 7 years, 8 years almost of, you know, master's education and many more after that for specific training for dissociative disorders. There's no CEU course that's going to make someone able to treat dissociative disorders. They can learn information, but it does not grant them authority or the skills to treat DID. I mean, I could never take a course on hormones and, you know, and then go treat my clients for hormones like you do your patients. That's just completely out of my scope. That is the biggest thing I want to share, is I would be perplexed if the doctor was continually allowed to conduct counseling with this patient and her alters. And I have emails upon emails supporting that they did counseling together for 5 years. And I also have more report from the patient from an old list I found of all the things that they did together as friends, which is deeply disturbing. And that's it.
Thank you. Dr. Payman, I see your hands up, but I need to move on because I need, and I'll get to you. But so far, for the sake of time, we've got a letter of concern, non-disciplinary with letter for CME. Dr. Rubin added a little bit to that. Can we get the skeleton of this outlined? I'd like the PBI course. That's 14 hours. I would also like a basic course in endocrinology. That can be done through several different organizations. And Dr. Rubin, you had something else. The problem with when we deal with certain subspecialties within psychological problems, issues, then if we don't have the foundation, it's difficult to dive into the subspecialties. I'd like something in behavioral health, but we'd have to move more at a foundational level for that rather than at a subspecialty level for that.
Well, my concern is, too, is, of course, you know, all education is good education, and whether or not we'll find anything that deals with the additional specialization that we've been talking about, I don't know. But of course, we don't, as a board, want to reinforce that by accomplishing that education, whatever it may be, is, you know, for lack of better word, licensed to go ahead and start, you know, dealing with patients in that realm. And so, you know, just again, just simply something, and this is just in my opinion, just something that says stay within the parameters of, you know, your many years of medical school to be a naturopathic physician and any additional board certifications that you may hold or licenses in the state of Arizona. If you stay within that, then everything is good to go with regard to, you know, how we perceive the situation, but don't go beyond that, because inevitably something could happen and then you're not covered because you're not trained.
I might add that I don't know if it's disciplinary action to ask for chart reviews through a licensed psychiatrist, MD level psychiatrist, for any patient that she's going to be co-managing who also has DID. Dr. Campbell, I would probably ask you if that's something that you would consider, and maybe we could amend the motion that's on the table.
Okay, that last part on mine, just completely, I didn't hear half of that question. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was saying, I didn't know if it was disciplinary action or not, but we might want to amend the motion because we always have the option of another professor in the community doing a chart review, such as the licensed psychiatrist MD level that could do chart reviews on several patients, next patients of hers that do have the idea that he's co-managing with somebody else. That was just an idea in terms of a way to have specialty oversight. Otherwise, we could throw out my motion and move on something else.
So, Dr. Rubin, this is Beth. So taking it's the level of chart reviews, that would kick it into probation, so that would be discipline, which the board can do, but the board would have to do that as a consent agreement at this juncture.
Got it. I think if we should just maybe restate where the motion is currently as it's been sort of talked about.
Do you want me to do that, Dr. Rubin?
I think that's up to Dr. Sadelec. I'm fine with it.
Ms. Cam, I think we got, I think we've got the peripheral of it. We've got the boundaries issue, which is PBI, and you're familiar with it too. I think I'd like to see some type of endocrinology in there that could be done through the American Academy of Endocrinology, AMA Category 1.
How many hours of seeing me in endocrinology were you thinking, Dr. Sadelec?
I'm thinking those courses are usually between 6 and 8.
Okay.
The behavioral health issue is a complex issue because there's so many different aspects of that. And that she's part of an association. It's not a board certification such as board certification in oncology, some of the other boards that are certified within the state. So perhaps Dr. Campbell, if there is a specific behavioral health course, it doesn't have to be a long course, that would help with prior triage, if you could look into that, I would appreciate it, because we could add that to this consent agreement.
Well, you know, if there was say an 8-hour course in evaluating a patient who comes to us, that is, self, admitting that they've got an issue or that you're picking up based on your observations that there may be mental health things and you want to do an evaluation of this patient so that you can then refer them out to mental health, then that's fine. I anything beyond that though, I don't want it to be, seen as a, that the board is, encouraging, or allowing, to take it above and beyond that. And again, once that patient is referred out to that mental health provider and you are working together with that mental health provider who you're doing the crux of the medical stuff and the mental health provider is doing the crux of the mental health range and you're working together, moving forward in the best interest of the patient, that's how it's supposed to work. And so as long as we can accomplish that through the CME, if there's an 8-hour course with regard to mental health evaluations by medical practitioners, then that's great. And then with regard to that second letter that Attorney Campbell spoke of, that we could accomplish, what the other things that we've talked about, and that would be great with me.
Okay. So in summary, I think we've gotten the majority of this done. Of course, in triaging of mental health, behavioral health board, I'm sure probably has something like that. That could be up to Dr. Payman to let the board know. We could insert that into the, non-disciplinary CME. We've already come up with a letter of concern, and I'll let, Attorney Campbell, go from here with it because we're almost done, I think. But
yeah, thank you, Dr. Sadelec. I like to make sure that I've got this stuff right. Right now, as I understand or as I've gleaned from the board's discussion, the board is considering a letter of concern for boundary issues, especially with regard to a patient with dissociative identity disorder, and further to include concerns about treating a patient whose mental illness may have exceeded the physician's competency, coupled with a non-disciplinary order for CME to include the 14-hour PBI boundaries course, which can be included in the physician's hours required for renewal, as well as 8 hours in mental health triage and at least 6 hours in endocrinology.
Correct.
And those are to be pre-approved by board staff, and the endocrinology and the mental health triage would not be eligible for inclusion for renewal.
I think that was Dr. Rubin's thought. Have you completed, Dr. Payman, have you completed CME for this year?
I've completed all of my CME for the year. I'm planning to attend the Psych AMP conference that's happening this weekend. And so that would add to, I don't know if, well, with that, I will have completed all of my CME for this year, but I'm happy to do more. I usually complete more than 30 hours per year anyway.
Okay. And Dr. Rubin, can I digress for one quick moment? Attorney Campbell at the very end was going over some things that you did not want as part of her CME that would have to be in addition to it.
But was that directed at me?
Yeah. Yeah. Did you have, I believe I'm going back about 40 minutes ago. Did you have part of her CME that you did not want as part of her 30 hours?
I honestly would amend my motion to whatever. I'm not particular about it anymore because okay. I had stayed the 12 hours. So, yeah.
Okay. So, Attorney Campbell, do you want to just go through what we got and so we could wrap it? We got
yes.
The PBI, et cetera.
Yeah, Dr. Sadlick, a letter of concern for boundary issues, especially with regard to a patient with dissociative identity order. Also, the letter of concern will include treatment of a patient whose mental illness may have exceeded the competency of the physician. In addition, the board will issue a the board is considering issuing a non-disciplinary order for CME to include the 14-hour PBI boundaries course, the 8 hours in mental health triage, and at least 6 hours in endocrinology, all of which can be included in the physician's hours for renewal.
I think
this
we
is
got
Dr.
Go ahead,
this is Dr. Rubin. I would like that to be my motion.
Okay.
Dr. Campbell seconds.
All righty. And then when did you want to have her complete this by? Do you want to give her 3 months, 6 months?
6 months.
Sounds good.
You okay, Dr. Cam, with that? Okay. So we have a motion. We have a second. And Dr. Payman, you have a quick – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Dr. Sad, like it's non-disciplinary, so you can do all in favor if you wanted to.
Okay. 2 minutes, Dr. Payman, then I have to move.
Okay. I just wanted to ease your concerns, Chelsea Ballard's concerns, as well as the board's concerns regarding my treatment of DID. I do not have any patients in my practice with that diagnosis at this time, and I will not do any counseling for anybody going forward with that diagnosis. I haven't before and I haven't since. It's not a strong interest of mine whatsoever to do that. The only reason that I did provide counseling for her was that she refused to continue to work with anybody else, and she reported to me continuously that my work with her was very helpful. So it's not an interest of mine and it's also, I understand the reasoning for that, the decision that I need to stay in my lane, so to speak, and do what I do best and refer for everything else. So I will do that. I've already established that boundary within myself. So I just wanted to assure the board that that is already in place.
Okay, good. I mean, just really try to drive your lane. And we've got a motion. We've got a second. So all those in favor of that motion, you say aye, please.
Aye.
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 Okay. Dr. Payman, you'll be hearing from our executive director then. Thank you.
Thank you.
We need to move on, board members, so let's try to keep at a good clip here. Anyone have any questions or concerns? Okay. We've got 5B and C, and these are three different cases. So case number 24-242, Ms. Anthony sent out a memo. That's two different patients within that case. And then we have 24-237. So let's try to get through these three cases. And I'll have Ms. Anthony go ahead and give us a review.
And Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is regarding case 24-237. On 7-11-2023, the board received a complaint from DO. The allegation listed in the complaint by DO is stated as, quote, doctor failed to comply with standard regulation, end quote, and she attached a demand letter allegedly drafted by an attorney in the complaint itself. According to the chart note, the procedure relating to this complaint took place on 9-13 of 2021. Records show DO called respondent on 9-27-2021 with a complaint about right buttocks pain. Respondent called in an antibiotic. An examination took place the next day on 9-28-2021. Respondent notes a moderate amount of diffuse swelling in the right buttocks. On 11-10-2021, a follow-up procedure is noted in which the right buttocks area is aspirated. A follow-up procedure to remove fibrotic tissue in the right buttocks took place on January 25, 2022. The complaint itself was not submitted to this board until 7-11 of 2023. We also know there was an attempt to collect monies from respondent in the form of a demand letter. In her original email to the board, dated 3-1-2022, DO lists several issues, including what appears to be vaginal bleeding with an onset a week after the procedure. She claims not to have had a period for over 2 years because she was on birth control, and that when she told respondent, he told her it was normal. There is no mention of vaginal bleeding in the chart notes. There is no way to know if DO was actually taking any medications because the patient history documents respondent provided the board in this case do not include any medication list.
Is the complainant on the line? No. And is Dr. Ortiz on the line?
I am.
Okay. Dr. Ortiz, do you have an attorney today?
I do. My attorney, Steve Mahaffey, is on the line with us.
Okay. Steve, are you there? I guess.
Perhaps. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so Dr. Ortiz, can you explain what transpired with the patient DO?
Yes. As stated by Ms. Anthony, DO came to see me for a procedure which I performed. The patient on the stated date contacted me regarding some pain. I responded by sending her a prescription and following up and seeing her the very next day. I observed and continued to treat. I treated the patient all the way up until January of the following year, to which time she stopped responding and stopped coming back. Somewhere in her complaint or the response from her attorney, there was some notification that she moved on to see a plastic surgeon as a result of the procedure that I performed, which is not true. If you look at the notes they sent, the patient went to see the doctor for breast augmentation. It's not until, I believe, the second or third visit with that doctor that there's any mention at all of anything that I performed. And there's no pictures, there's no other documentation other than the statement from the plastic surgeon that the patient was deformed. There's no pictures to that extent. There's no pictures of the buttocks or any documentation of the buttocks. Still haven't heard from the patient, and I have not heard from the attorney.
So for my clarification, what day did you actually do this procedure? She made the complaint on 7/11.
So the day that I performed the procedure was September 13th, 2001.
Did you have contact?
2021.
2021.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that was 9/13 of 21.
Correct.
Okay. Did you have contact with her between 9/13 and 21 to 7/11/2023?
No. So I had contact with her all the way up, as I previously stated, all the way up until January of 2022.
Okay.
And then she never came back to any follow-up appointments. Never called, never responded to any text messages.
And when she saw you the day after the procedure?
3 days after the procedure.
3 days after the procedure. Did you think she had a cellulitis? What was your clinical thoughts?
No, it is not uncommon during fat transfer cases for the areas to be red, hot, inflamed, achy. All of those are common symptoms.
Okay. And what?
So on antibiotics at the time.
You put on antibiotics when she left your office post-procedurally? Was she
post-procedure, yes, post-procedure. They're always on antibiotics post-procedure.
Okay. And refresh my memory, I looked at that yesterday, but what was the antibiotic you chose?
With the Cephalexin 500, BID.
BID, okay.
So she was on that for 2 weeks, and then the subsequent prescription was because she had run out of it and seemingly was complaining. So as a prophylactic, I put her on another prescription until I could see her, which I saw her in 24 hours, and I thought it was prudent to keep her on that for another 2 weeks.
Did you keep her on cephalexin, or did you move her to something like doxycycline or whatever?
I don't recall. Can I take a look at my notes? I don't remember exactly. That was 2 years ago. Nope, we gave her another round of cephalexin.
Okay. And we don't have the complaint on the phone. So let me start. Dr. Popio, you're recused. So Dr. Spatt, let me start with you and work that way.
This is Dr. Spatt. How are you doing, Dr. Ortiz?
I'm hanging in there. I would ask the board a little bit of leeway. My mom passed away a few days ago, so I'm a little bit exhausted, but I'm here.
Okay. All right. So with this patient, regarding, I still try to picture and I put down some of my notes, but so when was the last time you actually see her in person?
The last time I saw her in person was January. Let me look at the exact date. January of 2022.
Okay, so did you do assessment on the site where you did the procedure?
So we did the procedure, and she never returned after that. They never responded after. After I performed her, well, I'm sorry, let me make that clear. The procedure in January was to go in and aspirate out any necrotic tissue that was existing and to flush the area. And she never returned after that procedure and never responded to any of our phone calls.
Okay. So let's backtrack a little bit. So when you saw her, when you did the extraction, to debrief those necrosis, was there anything abnormal? Did he say anything about pain or any indication that would alarm you? I'm just curious.
Yeah, she just had an indurated area. It was no longer hot. She just had an area of necrotic tissue, so it's just really a firmness of the tissue. And on palpation, she would have some pain because she just essentially it was a necrotic hardened tissue underneath the skin.
Okay. And in your experience, have you experienced with this type of abnormal side effect before?
Yeah, sure. So necrosis is a part of fat transfer. It's something that is discussed with the patients and is written into the consent forms, which they sign. So there's going to be a percentage of patients that end up having some necrosis. Normally, it's just left for the body to absorb. But at times, we need to break it up or extract it via aspiration in order to make the patient more comfortable.
Okay, so let me understand, because I'm not familiar with the procedure that you do. So are you transferring a fat from somewhere else to another area? Is that what
Correct.
This is?
Correct, right. So the patient procedure was a liposuction 360, and then she had some of the fat transferred to her buttock area.
Okay, so when you say liposuction, did you do it? She do it with another plastic surgeon before she come to you? I just want to get this.
No, back. I performed that procedure.
You did, okay.
Yeah, that fat, just so you understand, the fat has to, and fat transfer has undergone many iterations over the 14 years that I've been performing the procedure. The way that we commonly do it now is in what's called a closed system. So the fat is aspirated into a sterile container. It's washed with an antibiotic wash, and then it's aspirated from that container into a syringe and or some sterile injecting device, and then placed back into the patient via a sterile cannula.
Okay. So with that in mind, so let's say after you do, well, let's say when you're done after a procedure, do you hire a outside private company to come in and clean your equipment, or how does this work?
No, I clean the equipment. I personally clean the equipment. And
you autoclave? You autoclave everything?
Everything is clean, sterilized, and autoclave per training, which I've received.
I see. Okay. So, let's stay with this patient. So how many procedures have you done similar in regard to this particular patient?
Oh, close to 1,000.
Okay. All right. So let me go back then. So you haven't seen her since January of 2020, and that was the last time you saw her. And then next thing you know is you got a letter from her attorney regarding to the complication?
Exactly.
I see. Okay. All right. Okay, well, I don't have any other question to ask, so thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Spatt. Dr. Rubin.
Hi, this is Dr. Rubin. Hi, Dr. Ortiz.
Yeah.
Is J plasma the same treatment you use as Renuvion?
J plasma, yes. So J plasma is an old name for Renuvion.
Whose Renuvion machine is it?
So Renuvion is a device that is manufactured by the Apex Corporation, and it utilizes radio frequency with helium gas in order to produce a plasma energy, which heats the tissue at about 180 degrees Fahrenheit, but for a fraction of the second, which causes the contraction of the tissue.
No. Whose device is it?
Mine. That's my device.
Oh, got it. Okay. How many procedures do you think you've done using that particular machine?
We've been looking at that lately. I want to say in the range of 50.
Okay. I mean, it seems like when the complainant had a meeting with Dr. Kraft, that really the only thing that I saw is that there was some, what did he say? This was on March 15th of 2022. Let me look at my computer. there was, it says appear to have liposuction and a superficial plan, which I think he means plain, with subsequent application of J plasma resulting in significant contour deformity. Discussed recommended excision of area with advancement of upper abdominal flap for closure. What do you think that means?
So post procedure, how the patient takes care of themselves, whether or not they gain weight, there you can have some rippling of the skin. An excess amount of superficial aspiration can cause those types of deformities, but so can an additional of weight, wearing the garment, the compression garment inappropriately, wearing it too long. And I'm speaking from a standpoint of I've also actually taught liposuction to a number of practitioners, including a thoracic surgeon, dermatologist, general surgeons. So I'm speaking from some area of expertise there. There's a number of reasons why you can have that kind of contouring. But in this particular case, the patient put on nearly 20 pounds from the time that her pre-procedure to the time that Dr. Kraft examines this patient. So it's hard to really tell what's going on in terms of any rippling or any contour deformities without seeing her or having even more of a general, the photographs that were provided were poor at best.
I'm sorry.
I'm on the line. No. I've been talking. I didn't know I was muted.
Okay. And who is this?
Daisy.
Oh, okay. This is a complaint. And did you?
I'm sorry. The individual that 602 last number is in 52. Who are you?
602. I'm sorry. If you're a patient, can you please use initials and tell us what case you're here for?
Oh, initials D.O.
D.O. Okay. We had asked for you about 20 minutes ago. We didn't hear from you.
Yes, I didn't know I was muted.
Okay. Well, we're finishing up with Dr. Ortiz, and then we'll talk with you.
Okay.
This is Dr. Rubin. Dr. Ortiz.
Yes, sir.
Okay. The procedures you performed were liposuction with fat transfer and then the J plasma, correct?
Correct.
Are these considered minor surgical procedures?
They are.
Okay. Dr. Sadalek, I don't have any more questions.
Okay. Dr. Campbell, let me move to you.
I'm going to hold off for now on my questions until after we speak with or hear from the patient.
Okay. And then Ms. Gellin, thoughts or suggestions?
I don't have any at the time.
Okay. D.O., I'm going to give you about 5 minutes max, so please keep your identification as D.O. and go ahead and give us a quick summation.
Okay. Yeah, I went to Dr. Ortiz to perform a BBL, and no, he did not call me. I was always the one calling them to schedule the procedure because he left me a big ball on one of my buttocks, and it took him over a month to be able to schedule me to drain me. And the last time I went for a follow-up, he took pictures of my stomach because he noticed that my stomach is all burnt, is all deformed over the J plasma. He never tried once to even call me to schedule or that nothing. I haven't heard. So when I went to Dr. Kraft, yes, it was for a breath appointment. But that same day, I asked him to look at my body, and he did. And he asked me who's the person that did this? And I told him who it was, and he reported it because he overprocessed my body. He overprocessed my skin. So he scheduled me for a different day to look, to have an appointment, to look and take pictures of my body. So, no, he hasn't, I haven't spoke to him or anything because he never reached out to me. Even when my butt was infected, I was the one reaching out to him.
Has Dr. Kraft corrected the problem, or is he or going to correct it?
No, yeah, he did, what's it called, he just quoted me on how much everything was going to cost me, and he, like, also let me know if I needed help or a letter or if anybody needed to talk to him, that he was willing to speak to them.
Okay. And you currently have, through MDK Law Group, you currently have a demand letter for Dr. Ortiz?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead, Dr. Ortiz.
There is currently no demand letter at this time. I've yet to receive a demand letter, and in fact, they are past the statute of limitations for that. The only letter I've received was the letter that they sent me.
Okay. Board members, this is Beth. So whether or not there's a demand letter is really not the issue before the board. The issue before the board is standard of care.
Dr. Ortiz, do you feel the standard of care was met?
Feel that the standard of care was absolutely met, and with regards to not keeping in touch with DO, if you look at the notes, there are a number of text messages, and at no time was DO neglected or not spoken to. I think she might be referring to a time where I was sick or something, and I did respond and let her know that I was ill, but I did continue to respond. Unless she has some proof where she reached out to me and I didn't answer her. Otherwise, these are all the text messages.
This is Dr. Rubin. Me going through that entire board packet seemed to me like the standard of care was met. What stuck out to me was what I brought up about the J plasma, Renuvion, or if it's just J plasma, that according to Dr. Kraft, who retrospectively claims that maybe it was heated too much. I'm not exactly sure what that means. I'm guessing maybe above 180 degrees, which would then result in significant deformity, which would then need to be repaired, which I'm guessing is part of the quote that DO, the complainant, received. But Dr. Ortiz, could you speak to that?
Yeah, I would like to say that without Dr. Kraft knowing what technique I use or even reaching out to me, which he hasn't, he has not ever reached out to me to ask me what I used or what technique. And in order to perform it, we don't control the temperature. What we control is the number of passes. And there's a number of passes that are literally prescribed per area. Now, I will also like to add that I recently have become a paid trainer for Apex utilizing the Renuvion technology. So I'm pretty sure that I know what I'm doing, and I've done several cases.
Dr. Rubin, thank you. I mean, for me, I'm not in the world of minor surgery, and so that to me is good. I don't have any more questions.
Do you have any documentation, Dr. Ortiz, from that company that you had, quote, training, continuing education?
Mm-hmm. So the board should be in possession of that, my training with the Renuvion, and I can get a letter stating that I am now currently a trainer for them.
And since DO, have you received any other complaints on
None.
This particular issue?
No.
Do you anticipate that?
It's possible. It's a technology, and it is the world of aesthetics. So, there are subjective issues, but, my technique is sound. And as I said, I've been hired by the company to actually teach. So they trust my ability. They've seen my work. And I don't have any current complaints, but it's a technology and anything is possible.
Okay. And as Dr. Rubin asked you, in your mind, you believe that this is part of, quote, minor surgery?
Absolutely.
Okay. And you say absolutely. Tell me what your thought is, what minor surgery is.
So where I'm not, the level of procedure that I work at is superficial layer. I don't do anything where I enter into the body, cut the body open. We use liposuction is small incisions utilizing a senescent anesthetic on under the skin, and some minor suturing if that. Normally we don't do suturing unless we remove skin, but those are all within the scope of my training and any additional training which I have received, which I have sent to the board, with the exception of a recent 16-hour CME course, which I just attended. I'm constantly training and learning and observing with other plastic surgeons, cosmetic surgeons, and anybody else performing these procedures. I do not perform any procedures where we cut into the body.
When you say cut into the body, what do you, Ms. Dr. Rubin, what do you mean by cut into?
Anything deeper than the superficial layer of skin. So and then removal of fat, which is what I would do when I remove a lipoma or anything else. I'm removing fat.
Okay. And this is that, to the extent that these questions are going to case 24242 instead of the case that the board is presently on involving, which is 24237 involving DO, the board may want to hold its questions regarding minor surgery until it gets to the case 24242.
Understood. This is Dr. Rubin. Understood. So, Dr. Ortiz, minor surgery then means not cutting below the superficial layer of the body, nor accessing or removing contents, tissues of the body that are deeper than the subcutaneous fat?
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
For the most part, the subcutaneous fat, since we are in fact trained to remove lipomas, which is in the subcutaneous fat space. So fat is fat. And whether we're removing a lipoma or we're removing fat.
Understood. Just getting clear. So nothing that you remove or that you put an instrument into go deeper than the subcutaneous fat layer.
Absolutely.
The,
right.
What?
Correct.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Yeah, I'm good, Dr. Sally.
Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask Dio a quick question?
Yeah, go right ahead, Dr. Spatt.
Dio, this is Dr. Spatt. I'm just curious. Besides Dr. Kraft, do you see any other plastic surgeon for a second or third opinion?
No, I just seen Dr. Kraft.
Okay, all right. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Campbell, can I move on to you? We went there with you before. I'm trying to wrap up 237. Any thoughts?
Nothing for me.
Okay. Ms. Gallen, any thoughts?
Nothing from me at this time.
Okay. Any other board member have any thoughts on case 237?
This is Dr. Spett. Could I ask Gail and Ms. Campbell, because this is where the gray area, even though Dr. Ortiz say that it's a minor surgery, but liposuction, I thought it's mean major surgery when it's come to light. Liposuction, is there a definition in our board regarding to this issue? If not, my suggestion is maybe we could send this case to an expert opinion to see what they say.
So naturopaths, it is within the naturopathic scope of practice to perform minor surgery. Whether or not Dr. Ortiz's practice, liposuction practice in this case constitutes minor surgery, that would be a board determination in the event that the board does require an expert to assist in that determination. The board could continue the investigation into this case to request such an opinion.
Okay. So, Gail, I don't know if this is the right time, but could we do that with this case at all? Because I'm not expert in any of this, and I don't want to make the decision regarding to something that I'm not familiar with.
And Dr. Spatt? Sorry, Gail.
No, go ahead, Beth.
In the event that the board does decide that it does want that expert opinion, the board would need to make a motion to continue this matter for additional investigation to include obtaining an expert opinion on whether or not the fat transfer in this case constitutes minor surgery as contemplated by the board statutes.
Okay, thank you.
This is Dr. Rubin. Thank you for that, Dr. Spatz. And that's what I was thinking in terms of, I understand removal of, but transfer from one to the other, I don't know if that, what the definition would be. And I would be in favor of moving this, or whatever the nomenclature is, for expert opinion on the matter. I don't feel qualified to define minor surgery in that sense as a board member.
I second that.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Campbell.
So Dr. Rubin, your motion would be to continue this matter for additional investigation to include obtaining an expert opinion as to whether the fat transfer in this case constituted minor surgery as permitted under the board statutes.
So moved, well stated, and excellently said. Thank you.
And Dr. Spatt, did you second that motion?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
You seconded. Okay. And then Dr. Ortiz, hold on a second because we got a motion. I just want to try to conclude this particular case. We'll go with all those in favor of that motion that was initially made by Dr. Rubin, seconded by Dr. Spatt. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Any opposed? No. And Dr. Ortiz, go ahead for a quick moment.
Very, very briefly and quickly, I'd like to have for the record that there are several practitioners that are utilizing liposuction and processing fat as fat-derived stem cells and injecting them, which is another form of fat transfer. And that has been done by a number of other practitioners and naturopaths that I'm aware of. So I just want the board to be aware of that and to take that into consideration as well when they're trying to define whether or not this is a minor surgical procedure.
I see your point. Okay, so we have moved to 237. Does the board want to roll through 242, which is two cases, or does the board want to break prior to getting into 242?
Bathroom break.
Yeah, okay. So, Dr. Ortiz, hang on. It's 2:21. Let's meet back here at 2:30, and we'll finish up with 242, the two cases that are rolled into that. Thank you. All right, Gail, I'm back.
Okay. Would you like me to take roll?
Can everyone hear me?
Yeah. Would you like me to take roll?
Yes, please.
Okay.
It's 232.
And Dr. Stablich?
Here.
Dr. Popio?
I didn't get that.
Did you try me? Dr. Popio?
I'm here.
Ms. Gallen? Ms. Gallen? Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Rubin?
Present.
Ms. Campbell, Ms. Gallen, are you with us?
Sorry, Gail, I'm here.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sorry, I should have turned on my camera.
No. Ms. Gallen, are you with us? Ms. Gallen?
Hi.
Are you with us?
Hello? This is Diva. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I don't know what was going on. For some reason, I wasn't on meeting.
Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Sadlick, we have quorum. And Dr. Popio is recused from this case.
Okay. So, Gail, can you give us we'll start with which would be easiest for you, RA or the other patient that was involved in 242?
I'll reference both of them in my summary, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Okay. And this is referencing case number 24-242. On 9-7-2023, the board received a complaint from VA. VA alleges on 7-15-2023, respondent performed several procedures on her. On 9-18-2023, the board received a complaint from RA, who alleges on 8-15-2023, respondent performed several procedures on her. Both patients reside in the state of Michigan, and both are related to Manel Abdallah, the nurse practitioner who works with respondent. According to the medical records, Ms. Abdallah was present during both patient procedures. Regarding VA's complaint, most of VA's complaints seem to center around her unhappiness with the outcome of the procedures. While she alleges she was not informed about a number of items, most of these items seem to be addressed on the consent to treat forms, which she did sign. She appears to want her money back and may be using the boards as a way to achieve this. She alleges an infection occurred to her abdomen area, but does not supply support for this statement. When asked specifically about the infection and who she received antibiotics from, she stated they were received from respondent. It does not appear VA presented with an infection to any other physician. Regarding RA's complaint, RA also complains about her unhappiness with the outcome of the procedures. However, in her case, she ultimately did develop an infection / sepsis cellulitis of left breast, breast abscesses, a diagnosis from a hospital state that required medical intervention. On October 3rd, 2023, the board contracted with Odessa Rodriguez for review of the case. And her report was attached to the board documents in the file.
And Dr. Ortiz, is still on the line?
I am.
Okay. And Mr. Mahaffer, are you still on the line?
I am, yes.
All right. So, Dr. Ortiz, by the way, are the complainants on the line?
Yes, sir. I am. I'm VA.
You're VA. Okay.
RA is here.
And RA is there. Okay. So when we get to you guys, I'll give you 5 minutes apiece. But Dr. Ortiz, you want to give us a quick rundown?
It's hard to do a quick rundown. This is a pretty involved case. Both VA and RA are relatives of a person that works in my office as an independent contractor, Manal Abdallah, who is also on the call and here to testify today. They originally, Ms. Abdallah came to me and asked me to see VA, who was interested in getting some injectables done vis-a-vis Botox and filler, hyaluronic acid filler. The day that they were scheduled to come in, VA arrived with her two children, RA, and another child that we won't name here. And while waiting in my waiting room, they observed some of the other procedures which I performed, and excitedly asked Manal if there was an opportunity for me to perform the procedures which they subsequently asked for. The consultation ended up being a 2-hour visit, which I extended only because she was the relative of Manal, who is somebody who she asked me specifically if I could do this favor. This was an aunt. This was somebody that she really desperately wanted to help. I said I would see what I could do. During that initial consultation with VA, both of her daughters, RA and another daughter, became highly interested and wanted to potentially schedule appointments with me. We consulted with all three of them. We set an appointment to get VA's procedure done, explaining to her that she would have to take some time because she was from out of state. We performed the procedure just a few days later, which took a whole lot of effort to get pre-ops done and everything else that needed to be done. We were able to accomplish that during the procedure, which entailed liposuction, fat transfer, and removal of skin. A paniculectomy was never performed. Unfortunately, the terminology paniculectomy was used. What was actually done per the notes, and Manal will testify to that. as well, that we did liposuction with removal of the superficial layer of skin. At no time was VA or RA ever opened up. I've never opened up a patient. I've never cut into a patient, just superficial skin. The photograph which VA's submitted to the board, which was taken by Manal Abdello, will verify that what was done was just removal of skin. VA has her procedure done. She is in a hurry to get back to Michigan because she needs to travel then later on to, I believe she was heading back to Jordan or someplace out of the country. So we released her, but I stayed in constant contact with her by texting, phone calls, and at some point she discussed having, at some point she became upset after her daughter's procedure was performed, which is RA, and started to make some claims that don't even add up, because she discusses having gushing fluid a day after she submits photos, which I've submitted to the board along with an enlargement of the wound that was basically healed and closed. So at this point, I haven't seen VA because she lives in the state. I don't have photographs or anything past the last photograph that she submitted. Everything that is done that was performed was standard of care. Regarding RA came to the clinic exactly 1 month after VA's procedure was performed. Her sister was due to have her procedure done the next day, but called 6 days earlier to reschedule and subsequently just cancel. But we performed her procedure as she requested, which involved several areas of her body, liposuction of several areas of her body with Renuvion, as well as the removal of some skin, which she requested. The removal of the skin, first off, I'd like to state that at no time were either of these patients under general anesthesia. Don't perform, general anesthesia is not utilized in my office. I have board certified anesthesiologists that administer LMAC, which is local monitored anesthesia care. If a review of their notes will show that that's exactly what they performed. In fact, they checked that off. The patients were consented to that and signed off on that. Regarding the number of hours, it's irrelevant, the number of hours, it's however long it takes to complete the procedure. The patients were constantly monitored by a board-certified anesthesiologist. The board's in possession of those anesthesiologist credentials. Both of them are board-certified and have several years of experience. RA subsequently developed an infection. Later on, she complained of some swelling chills, not fevers. I monitored her intensely, texted with her several times a day, asked for her to monitor her temperature. She was on antibiotics. RA was, both patients, RA and VA, went home and were recovered by their relative, Manal, who is, not just a, nurse practitioner, but she's also a first assist, meaning she is qualified to do the suturing, and she actually did all of the suturing in both of the cases. I merely made the superficial incision and the dissection of the superficial layer of skin. Manal was the person who actually performed all of the suturing. In fact, that's why both RA and VA came to me. They felt comfortable. They felt confident. They were happy. They were both given significant significant discounts on their procedures. In addition to that, Manal participated in paying a portion of VA's procedure and working off a significant portion of her procedure in order to make it work for her so that we could actually get done what she had requested. Regarding RA's subsequent cellulitis, there I noticed that the term sepsis was brought up. The diagnosis was cellulitis and abscess of the left breast. The patient was never septic. Her vital signs will show that. In the emergency department, her blood was cultured and found to be sterile. So there was no infection in her blood. So at no time was she ever septic during the time that she was in the hospital, at least given the reports that I received. I only have the medical reports from the hospital that were given to me from the board. I think in summation, there was nothing out of scope of practice. I did not perform a paniculectomy. There was no general anesthesia performed. And I'll take questions.
Let me start off with VA, since we have you on the phone. And then we'll go into board questions. Hey, can you give me a 5-minute rundown, please?
Yes, the rundown is I went into the office with my niece. She does not work for him. I know that for sure. She's even written it in text messages. Since then, I don't know what their business is. I don't live there. But at the time that I went there, he was willing to let her learn and train free. I did have a problem with Dr. Ortiz when he did the consultation. He made it sound so easy. I did tell him I am traveling. I had a very important occasion in another country in Jordan. He said, you're going to go back brand new. My machines are different than anything. But he did state this exact words. He said, I am not a plastic surgeon. I said, okay, but you are like a real medical doctor that can cut and do whatever, you know. I never understood the NMD. That's number one. Number two, my niece, I felt comfortable. Yes, she's my family. You know, anybody would feel more comfortable. Number three, propofol. I was under general anesthetic. That's not at all the truth. This I'm 100% sure of. It's propofol. It was an extensive hour, 7 hours. My complaint actually is not even just about getting a refund. That's not going to quiet the problem. My stomach area till now is hard as a rock, completely numb. Where my private area is, I have no telling of sensation of urination. I just acquired actually health insurance to go to a health doctor. I did tell the Miss Gale, I think, that I was going back and forth with emails that I did not have health insurance. I do have health insurance now to actually try to get past what I am going through. My stomach is in one area where my private part is completely numb, hard. I don't have a sensation. I was told specifically in front of many witnesses that he reached my muscle trying to get the, I had a C-section was the major thing, an up and down C-section. I wanted to get rid of the scar. I never even heard of the word paniculectomy except from him. Even on the paper that I signed, it says, he wrote the word but spelled it wrong. It's a different meaning. The word he has written is removal of penis, pector, whatever, on his papers. So I know that's what it is that he was supposed to perform. He said if any of the scar was left, it would be in my bikini area. I did send a picture of what was removed, what part. So at the time, yes, my main concern was looking at my stomach, and it looks horrible, and I do up until this day look horrible, but my main concern now is not just the horrible look. It's actually the getting the sensation back, because it's not just numb, it's hard numb, and my urine problem is a very big problem. My private part is pulled way up. So, yes, I am going to a medical doctor. I do have insurance now to help me through whatever it is, the problem. But, yes, he did cut. I was told 100% by him and Manel, and I was there. I have an IV in my arm. I was completely knocked out. The anesthesiologist herself came in. She completely said I was being knocked out with propofol, whatever the stuff is. That's what it was. It was over 6 hours, a very, very long procedure. Nothing was explained to me. I never even had the papers with me, because I was supposed to bring in the papers signed, so I forgot them, because he was going to go over them with me in his office. I got there. I said, I forgot the papers. They had to call my daughters and whatever. Then the lady that worked there, his girlfriend, printed new ones out and literally took less than 30 seconds, just had me sign everything. I had no idea what I signed, how I signed, what anything said. He's like, this is just for media. This is for whatever. And he specifically said it would be like going to exercise, over-exercising for 2 days. He knew I had to travel. He's the doctor. Apparently, he could have said, I can't do it. He made everything sound so good. My daughter is a PhD. So she's a pharmacist, doctor of pharmacy. And my other daughter's a lawyer, both well-educated. So his procedure sounded so simple and easy and quick and no recovery time, and that they actually right then and there decided in the off, in that little room where we all were, that they wanted to do it. So no educate, both work, both have to go to work, to court and to pharmacy. So I'm not at all adding or subtracting of what is happening. My niece herself quoted to me, had I known these were regular machines, I would have told you. I think I even have some sort of this stuff in text messages. I thought that they were something new, Auntie. I didn't know they were like all the rest. But no, the penicillectomy was called that and was that. He did cut me open. He did put me under general anesthesia. Not at all was I aware. I was completely knocked out. Even to the point I even said, because he tried to poke me and he couldn't. And my niece tried to poke me to get the IV in, and she couldn't. The anesthesiologist came in, and she poked me twice until she got the needle in through where they had poked the vein. And I actually asked her, I said, are you sure? Because I feel burning, and I was scared. I'm like, you're the most important one. You know, I don't want to feel this, and I don't want to just fall asleep either forever, you know, so I made those comments, and they were real fear, because I did feel that, and it was not a surgical center, and yes, I was cut open, and yes, it is deep, and yes, it is now a very painful matter, other than I'm looking at what I'm in now, what actually he did to me. I don't know what he did. I'm going to a medical doctor to find out, to resolve my issues. It's been since July 15th. So much of these things that are normal should have subsided a lot, but being this much numb, even to ice, I do check myself, yes, putting ice on that part, touching it, it's very hard. My private area is pulled way up out of place. The cut was cut by him, and it's very long. It's not even straight. Again, now I'm not talking about cosmetically. There is dysfunction in my body. So for now, that's all I have to say, unless you have any questions. You gave me a limited amount of time. I appreciate your time, but I just wanted to set things straight. My daughter is a pharmacist. She made sure, and she asked him many medical, she even asked what kind of anesthesia is going to be used, the medicine that they're going to use, and was told what kind. They were actually, when I was in the room, they took so long. My daughters kept calling. They were worried why the procedure took so long. That's when we were told by my niece and by the doctor when I went to the office visit that why it was very hard and he was going to give up. He literally stated so many times, I have so much fat. So because I went there for loose skin and to get rid of the scar. He said, no, you have a lot of fat. You need some liposuction. He got a syringe, like a tiny small syringe and a half, I think, which the same size syringe as you give insulin to. So it's a very small amount. So doing lipo for that many all over my body and getting that little amount of fat is not normal. And putting me under anesthesia for that long and cutting me, and that's a major surgery. Penicillectomy is not a minor surgery. That's what he called it. That's what it was supposed to be. But he didn't do it properly, obviously. And that's it for now.
Okay. Thank you, VA.
You're welcome.
I've made notes. All right. Can I roll with you? And then I'm going to have to roll with my board members.
Yes, I'm here. And I do have all my medical records. To have a doctor here sit here and say that my condition wasn't serious is beyond me, because as soon as I was feeling the uncontrollable pain in my body, I texted him saying, listen, I think I have an infection. I have all of this in messages. And he kept brushing it off and brushing it off until the point where I collapsed. My mom had to come here and take me. We went to the urgent care where they said, you are in early sepsis. You don't need drainage. He said, go to urgent care and be drained. He called the urgent care near my house and talked to a physician assistant and said, this is what she needs done. So when I got there, the physician assistant that looked at my breath said, absolutely not. I am not touching you. This looks like an infection. I was so pale. I had a high fever. I was shaking, but sweating at the same time. So I was in early sepsis. It's in my medical records. I went into deep sepsis where I was on 3 antibiotics where they have to revive me. It's in my medical records, and I can read it into the record. And stop looking at and shaking your head like that, please. Okay? To have to even look at your face where I almost died because of your negligence, you should be in jail right now. Okay? You did perform a penicillectomy. I went to a plastic surgeon. It's in my medical records.
Okay. RA, this is the board's attorney. Can you please direct your comments to the board instead of to Dr. Ortiz, please?
He needs to get off the camera and stop saying that, because I can't talk while looking at her face like that.
Okay. And RA, it is your right to make a statement or not to make a statement.
I do want to. Because everything he said is false. I was under general anesthesia. I was. I was under for 9 hours. I was very dissatisfied the moment I got out of the surgery. I was in so much pain. When I got back to Michigan, when I was on the plane and I got back to Michigan, my mom came over that Sunday night. I couldn't even get out of bed. And I texted him. I said, listen, I don't feel well. I think I have an infection. That very next day, he said, no, it's probably from the pressurization of the cabin. Take your temperature. I'm like, and he's like, send me a picture of your breath. I sent the picture. Instead of telling me right away to go to the emergency room, he waited 4 days until I was like, no, that's it. My mom came over. I'm like, listen, I don't feel good. I can't even work. I can't function. He's like, your breath just needs to be drained. I do this all the time. I was like, I don't even know where I would do that. So he's like, go to the nearest urgent care. I went to the nearest urgent care. They wouldn't even touch me. So then they said, you need to go to the emergency room as soon as possible. So then I went to the emergency room. And that's when, as in the emergency room documents, the first one when I was actually seen, they said I was in early sepsis. And then even after them trying to take out the infection, and after giving me morphine and putting me on 3 antibiotics, which is all documented, they still couldn't figure out why I still had a high fever. My blood pressure was down. My oxygen levels were down. This is all well documented. And that's when the plastic surgeon said, listen, you have one option. We go in procedurally to cut you open and get out the infection because it's the antibiotics that you're on aren't working. So that is when they went in, they did the procedure. I decided to do the procedure, which I still have a lot of pain in that breast. I saw a plastic surgeon after this day three times, and he had to yet again get a big needle and poke me to get more guts out, whatever it is that he put in it. And it's not even about cosmetic, but I have one breast that's a size of an apple and another a size of a watermelon because of what he did. Yes, I did almost die. It's in my medical record. I did go into sepsis. So if you want to fabricate medical records, go right ahead, but it's in my medical records. Also about my stomach issue. Yes, I went in to get skin removal. I didn't go in for a kind of whatever it is. I didn't even know that word until he said it. It's on his own consultation. I didn't go in for a discount. I paid $15,000, which when I came back to Michigan and knew all this when I was awake, that's actually such a high amount for such a procedure. So he took the fat in my stomach and he put it in my boob and in the process didn't sterilize whatever it is that he did because the infection that I got, according to the surgeons I've seen or spoken to here in Michigan, is not normal. It's not common to get sepsis from a fat transfer. So while he thinks I'm only here making this complaint because of monetary, I'm an attorney. I make $15,000 a month, more. I don't need a discount from him. I could have done this in Michigan, but I trusted my cousin. I trusted this doctor, what he was saying. So, yes, my stomach right now is numb, actually. I did those post-op massages for 6 weeks. It's still numb. I can't feel anything on where he cut on the bottom. I have extra skin on my right side than I do on my left. It's my line is lopsided. So how is any of this normal? So obviously this doctor is a fraud. He does not know what he's doing. We were under general. Actually, he told me the reason why anesthesia was, I believe, 3,000 something is because it's general anesthesia. We were put to sleep. I was under for 9 hours.
Also,
the doctor, Dr. Galina, the plastic surgeon who is a plastic surgeon in Michigan, in my medical records, she did see my area, my abdomen, and she even stated that that a penile-ectomy was done. It's in my medical records as well. And those were all sent to the board.
Thank you, Rose.
And one more thing, out of all of this, I have PTSD, okay? Sorry, because, Dr. Ortiz keeps rolling his eyes. I have PTSD. I was in the hospital. They had to bring numerous people to calm me down because I couldn't stop crying because of the pain I was in, the emotional trauma I was in, not knowing what was going to happen next because of what was going on. All because, you're going to have, this is all artificial, you're going to recover in 2 days because he knows I work out every day. He's like, it's just like a sore work, getting sore from a workout. He knew that I had to go back to work, that I could only be in Arizona for 1 week, that I had 2 minor children and a husband at home. So he didn't tell me you have to stay longer, you needed more care, your breast might have needed to be drained, or any of that.
I got it, Rose.
I have one more thing to say. After my mom,
wrap up. Go ahead.
After my mom had her concerns with Dr. Ortiz, my sister and I were actually going to cancel our procedure. However, My cousin and Dr. Ortiz assured my mom that because we are younger than my mom, we would have no issues like my mom did. Absolutely no issues. And the fact that I had already paid $10,000 out of $15,000 and I knew I wasn't going to get it back, I did the procedure because he reassured my mom over and over again that we would be in good hands, but obviously we weren't. Thank you.
All right. Board members, let me start off. Dr. Rubin, can I roll down the line with you and start with you?
This is Dr. Rubin. I make a motion to go into executive session for legal advice.
I'll second your motion, and we'll go into executive session. It's 3:04. Is everyone concurrent going into executive session?
And you do need to take a vote, Dr. Sadlick.
Even a roll call?
You can do it voice vote.
Okay. Is anyone that's opposed to going into executive session? All those in favor say aye.
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 Okay. We'll meet in executive session.
Board members, please turn off your mics and jump off of this line and jump back and jump onto the executive session link. Thank you.
And it's 3:05. Thank you. Gail, are you back online?
I am.
All right. It is 3:38, and we are back into regular session. And can we do roll call?
Dr. Sadlick?
Here.
Ms. Gollin?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Rubin? Dr. Rubin?
Still muted. This is Rubin's here.
Okay, thank you. We have quorum, Dr. Sadlick.
Okay. There are two hands that are up. Board members, we can either listen to the hands that are up or move to our next agenda item. Does anyone want to hear from the hands that are up, or does someone want to make a motion?
This is Dr. Rubin. I'd like to make a motion.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Rubin.
I'd like to, in my opinion, before I make a motion, we need additional clarity. Only because I need more clarity, well, I think the board does, on what this procedure was, what it involved, because it seems like there's some inconsistencies in testimony, and also on type of anesthesia used, review of the notes, and rendering of an opinion on whether or not this qualifies as general or what, just clarity for the board. So I make a motion that we continue this, have Dr. Ortiz, our expert, review her testimony, re-review the clinical notes in context of what we've heard today and work with Gail on that, and then bring that back hopefully to our next board meeting, as well as have Ms. Anthony see if she can locate an anesthesiologist to opine on and narrate for us so we can review that at the next meeting about the anesthesia that was used, the type, and descriptors therein.
We have the anesthesiologist on the line.
Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is Gail. Dr. Ortiz, there were two anesthesiologists.
Yep.
Are they both on the line?
One of them is on the line now.
I have pictures of the surgery room with the propofol showing in it.
The anesthesiologist for VA's case is on the line.
Okay.
Hello, hi. This is Dr. Jessica Tomasello.
Okay.
So I'm a board certified anesthesiologist.
Excuse me, Doc. We're trying to get a motion passed, and that's fine. So just hold on a second. So, okay. Dr. Rubin, you made the motion, and does any board member want to second that motion?
This took the slide. I second that.
You second it. Okay. So, and we'll probably get to you, Doc, next meeting. And we got a second, and then I'm going to do a quick roll call. Everyone in favor say aye. Those not in favor say nay.
Aye.
Okay. All right.
Dr. Sadlick, can you ask for the nays separately just so Gail gets a good count for the minutes?
Sure. The nays, board members, the nays. Any nays? Okay, we'll move to formal hearing.
No.
Thank you.
Wait. That's not what I heard the motion.
That was not the motion. It was for some additional investigation, correct, Dr. Sadlick?
Yeah. Dr. Rubin, did you want to move that to formal hearing? Are you trying to get additional information?
My motion was to move this for additional information to bring to us. Yeah. Okay. For the next board meeting.
He's continued.
To be continued. All right. So we are done with that. We need to move on. We still have quite a heavy agenda. Anyone need a break? No? Okay. So let's move on to 5 Diaz and Dogs. That's Patricia Lovelight. Are you on the line? Okay, I guess not. Ms. Anthony, can you give us a quick rundown on Lovelight? Gail, you there?
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Members of the board, this is case number 24-240 regarding a unlicensed person by the name of Patricia Lovelight, a.k.a. Pat Atwood. It's important to note that this is the second time Ms. Lovelight has been before the board for use of title. Case number 20-154 was heard by the board on 7-9-2020. At that time, the board gave Ms. Lovelight 30 days to remove the title from her website. The board dismissed the case after the after review of the completed work at that time. She is now using, although she was brought before the board for the same use in 2020, she continues to use the title, advertising herself as a naturopath and ND. Board staff recommends issuance of a cease and desist letter, forwarding the case to county attorney and possibly filing an injunction with the court.
Is Patricia Lovelight on the phone? She is not. Board member, since we've already dealt with this twice, would you like to just move this to the Attorney General Office for investigation?
If that's a motion, I would second it.
I make the motion then.
Dan Rubin seconds.
Okay, and then we need all those in favor.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay. I need a nay.
Aye.
Okay. No nays. Okay. Melissa, are you on the phone? This is another unlicensed.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Ms. Anthony, could you give us a review of case number 22-233?
Gail, are you on?
Gail, are you there?
I'm sorry. My mic was off. Board members, this is the third time this person has been before the board for this particular case. At the meeting of June 8th, 2023, the board reviewed the case and allowed her 60 days to remove the title. She appeared at the August meeting where she stated the Facebook listings were recently removed. The board requested the matter be placed on the September meeting for confirmation of the removals. At the August, on August 29th, 2023, board staff performed a general online Google search and two Facebook listings appeared in the search along with several other items, and you've received that summary.
Melissa?
Yes.
Let me ask you, because this is the third or fourth time, what seems to be the problem in not having your name up as a licensed provider?
It is gone. I actually sent a very detailed letter through Ms. Anthony on the 8th of September, detailing why it's not showing in Google. It's an internet thing. Google is not always reflective of the up-to-date listings. It almost serves as a memory bank of everything that ever was. So, and I did a check today and I still have things that show up under the old name, but when you click on them and it takes you to the live site, you will actually see the information has been updated and changed. It's all been removed. I cannot. It's literally impossible for me to have the old name and the new name on a Facebook page coexisting. It doesn't happen, but Google doesn't update that. So you have to click those links to go through to the live site, and you will see that it's all been done. It was done before the last time I appeared, but the search that had been done was 8 days before I was even able to make the change. Sorry, 6 days before I was even able to make that change. And it appears that letter where I responded to each and every listing has not been forwarded. And it also included all the emails I sent to Ms. Anthony detailing exactly what I'd done to be in compliance with what you've asked. So it's a little frustrating from my end as well as yours, because I got onto it straight away and did everything you've asked, but I can't change the fact that Google does not update things, and it can list things that are 10 years old. You simply have to go to my actual live Facebook page and you'll see that everything that was asked to be removed is gone.
Board members, questions, ideas?
I have a question for our executive director. Is the testimony consistent with the findings from your investigation?
The findings from my investigation are just the Google search.
Okay.
That's coming up on the general Google search.
And I know that we've had another case before where there was a little bit of difficulty with regard to old things that had been deleted appearing, and then in addition to the new information that replaced it that falls in compliance. Do you think that could be what's happening now with this case as the testimony was given?
And Dr. Campbell, you're asking for my opinion on that?
Yeah, have you seen this before where it, in other words?
Yeah, so when you, it could be that when you click on those links, it takes it to the new information. The problem is when you're doing a general Google search, all of that information is still reflective on there. So it's really up to the board what you want to do in terms of how far you want to take this. There are people out there that do Google, or actually do internet scrubs. I believe can get rid of that.
Can I speak?
Not yet. Other board members?
Thank you, Ms. Anthony.
Dr. Spath, Dr. Popeo.
Go ahead, Dr. Spath. Okay. Googling and, her website does not suggest she's a doctor at this point. Obviously, I'm trying to find the Facebook page, but it seems like she's taken a lot of steps at this point to try and rectify this. And I can imagine that just dealing with the internet and all that, I don't know if we need somebody to spend thousands of dollars to try and remove any trace of that, or if updating their current information is adequate based on what efforts they've put forth.
It really does seem like she has made a credible effort to maintain compliance with the board, and that any further communication on her behalf will be compliant with the law and regulations of the board. And so understanding from the perspective of the public, I think that we can, at least from my perspective, I feel comfortable in going ahead and dismissing the case. I would just ask her to remain cognizant of the fact that if somebody else was to come up with that information and file a new complaint, she might on her own consider finding somebody who can scrub that information for her. I don't know that we need to order it and demand it at this point, but that might be something that she remains cognizant of. That she may want to take action on her own to avoid future misunderstandings. But if the board will indulge me, I feel comfortable making a motion that as a result of all the actions that have been taken to maintain compliance with the board, that we dismiss the case.
And Melissa, you had something you wanted to say. I was trying to get the board organized, but go ahead.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I've spoken with a number of internet experts, and they basically said, and one of them's the head of data at Nestle, and said, once it's out there, you can't get rid of it. It hangs on to everything, but all I can do is update the live information that I have control of, which I have done. So if anybody came across, say, the outdated information on Google regarding to my Facebook, if they click into it, it's gone. So they're not going to get any further with that. My website's up to date. I've asked anyone that I have found sharing my information to change it. Not everybody has been helpful with that. I've found a lot of data crawling websites. You might be familiar that a lot of websites collect health providers' information and list them without your consent. Some of them have removed it. A lot of them have not. But the ones I've been able to deal with and have at least updated the information so that when you click onto it, it brings the new information that has eliminated the word naturopath from there. And it, you know, I am a nutritionist, I am a herbalist, so on. All of that's in there, but not naturopath. So I've done everything I could and got all the advice I can. I simply don't have thousands of dollars to, I wish I did, to get someone to scrub it, if that's even possible. I would love to do that, but I haven't worked since this began.
Hi, we appreciate your efforts. Is anybody on the board willing to second my motion?
Yes, this is Dr. Popio. I second Dr. Campbell's motion.
Any nays on the board? So, Melissa, please just really, really watch that. Because if it, I really don't want to have this come back to us again. So we got a motion, and it sounds like we've got a consensus to basically dismiss it. And hopefully it's gone for good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, members of the board. I appreciate it.
Do we need to vote on this, Mr. Chairman?
We just need to pick a yays.
Yeah, I took yays and we had no nays. So.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Okay. But thank you, Dr. Scott. I appreciate it. Let's move on to 5F as in Frank. And that's Diane Kaiser. Is she on the line? 24-241. No Diane Kaiser? Okay. This is another unlicensed individual. And Gail, can you give us an overview?
Yes, Dr. Sadlick, members of the board. This complaint came about from two licensed naturopathic physicians complaining about Ms. Kaiser's use of naturopathic doctor, ND, practitioner. The site, one or two of the sites do list her as a practitioner in Sedona, Arizona. So the board should have received my summary on this. Also, you would have received something that, and I don't even know what to call this, and maybe our attorney general has a better handle on what this is supposed to be, but Ms. Kaiser has filed some sort of recording with the Yavapai County court system. She calls it notice of jurisdictional boundaries in the form of a sworn verified affidavit. The board should have received that as well.
Can we give me an opinion?
Sure. And I'm happy to provide any advice that the board requires in executive session, but I don't think that really impacts what the board needs to do in this case.
Oh, okay.
Dale, this is Dr. Popiel. So it sounds like she was interested based on what I was reading and kind of coming into compliance with you, and then all of a sudden that oddity in the letter comes about. Is that correct?
Yeah, it appeared that way.
Okay. So it seems like this would be something to send on to the Attorney General for a cease and desist.
Gail actually sends the cease and desist. Gail, have you sent the cease and desist yet?
No, I have not.
So, you know, we can pursue an injunction, but before we do that, we need to make a paper trail pretty much. So I would recommend at this point that the board go ahead and send a cease and desist to, Ms. Kaser. And then the board can, if there continue to be issues or if there's a non-response, the board can take further action after the cease and desist.
Do we need a motion on this?
Yeah, if you could instruct Ms. Anthony to issue a cease and desist to Ms. Kaser.
I'll make the motion that Ms. Anthony sends a cease and desist to Diane Kaser.
Is Dr. Popiel, I second that.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay.
Aye.
Aye.
Any nays? No? Okay. It is 10-4. We can keep rolling. We have review consideration possible action regarding petition to amend consent agreement requirement. Orville Warwick is, are they still on the line?
Dr. Sadlick, I was going to say Mandy Carvis's associate, Adam Castillerin, is supposed to be here, and I apologize for getting your name, your last name, so terribly wrong.
No, you're fine. It happens all the time.
Am I online?
Yeah, Adam. Are you representing Dr. Warwick?
Yes, and Dr. Warwick is on the line as well.
Okay.
Can you see me?
I see your name. There we go. Okay, I got you. And Ms. Anthony, can you review this for us?
Yes, Dr. Sadlick, members of the board. The board received a petition from Dr. Warwick. The background on this is on January 17, 2018, Dr. Warwick entered into a consent agreement, agreement number 16-059 with the board for suspension, restriction, and probation. And you should have, you received a copy of that consent agreement in your packet. Pursuant to the agreement, respondent is required to have a practice monitor. Part of the consent agreement states after 5 years of the effective date of the order, respondent may petition the board to terminate this requirement or reduce the number of charts reviewed and or frequency by submitting a written request to the board, which he has done. In summary, the findings of facts in this case were serious enough to rise to the level of permanent state suspension and permanent probation. According to his petition, Dr. Warwick is, quote, paying the practice monitor $220 an hour to carry out chart reviews. When asked about his office locations, Dr. Warwick stated his primary practice is for health and wellness located in Payson, Arizona, and that he also occasionally sees patients at Scottsdale Zane and Laser, located in Scottsdale, Arizona. When Dr. Beard, who is Dr. Warwick's practice monitor, was asked if she reviewed records from both locations, Dr. Beard states, quote, I have not seen a chart from Scottsdale Zane and Laser, and I was not aware Dr. Warwick worked there, end quote.
And Dr. Warwick, are you on the line?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Your comments?
The practice monitor has received charts from Scottsdale Zane and Laser, but they were perhaps not as clearly marked as to the site of origin as they could have been.
And why is it that you're coming back to the board? Are you trying not to have the chart requirement?
That is correct. It is cost prohibitive for me and
the cost that I would have to pass on to patients. So at this time, I am only seeing existing patients on an as-needed basis.
And Dr. Sadlick, you may want to ask Adam. I know that they had some proposals as to I know they're asking for termination, but I think Adam also was prepared to make some other requests, so you may want to take the opportunity to hear from him as well.
Okay, thank you. Adam, can you tell us what else you had proposed?
Sure, just in the alternative of eliminating the practice monitor altogether, we also propose that the board consider the practice monitor only reviewing charts in which Dr. Weirich has prescribed controlled substances other than hormones, or that the practice monitor not review any charts completed during the time in which Dr. Weirich has no DEA license to prescribe controlled substances, which he currently does not have. I don't think his business model is envisioning him getting that. He may get it in the future, but that can be something that we raise before the board to alert them before that circumstance happens.
Speaking of Dr. Popiel, Dr. Sadlick, do you mind if I ask a couple questions?
No, please, go ahead.
Okay. Dr. Weirich, I certainly appreciate you wanting to remove the practice monitor. I guess my question would be, you know, you had mentioned well, there was some conversation of financial hardship and paying the practice monitor. I know there was a sale of a ranch. My question for you would be if, you know, if these are all removed and you're going back to prescribing controlled substances, my concern would be is that if there is financial hardship, is there going to be any sort of push to make decisions in allowing, you know, morphine and controlled substances to become a driving force in your practice again in the future?
I would say that at the present time, I consider the practice of prescribing narcotics to be at high risk legally, and it is not on my business plan horizon.
Okay, And I apologize, Gail, is there a restriction in Dr. Weirich's ability to get a DEA license at this point?
There was a restriction for 1 year. I'm looking through it now, so if you could just give me a minute.
So Dr. Popiel and Adam can correct me if I get this slightly wrong. I believe at one point Dr. Weirich was prohibited from prescribing all controlled substances. I believe though that was subsequently removed. And he is now able, as part of his practice monitoring, to prescribe those controlled substances. I understand the matter. Aside from the hormone replacement controlled substances, testosterone, he does not currently prescribe controlled substances. The board could consider, I know he's on a permanent probation, is amending that permanent probation to preclude him prescribing all controlled substances. And I don't even, if he is, except testosterone, if that's what he's prescribing, I don't know that that's the case. It's a pretty easy thing to check because, I mean, that all that information is on the CSPMP. So, Gail would be able to monitor, that sort of permanent practice, restriction, practice, probation fairly easily.
I just wanted to point out page 37 of the consent agreement. There's a permanent restriction from dispensing controlled substances classified as opioids and certifying patients for medical marijuana. So he's permanently restricted from that, okay, this consent agreement.
And that is, and I recall that that's for opioids. It doesn't have benzodiazepines in it.
And Gail, yeah. This is Dr. Mobile. Is that dispensing or prescribing?
I'm sorry, Dr. Mobile, he interrupted you. Can you go ahead and say?
I just didn't know if that was for, if there was a permanent restriction on dispensing or prescribing. Because I know that some docs will have controlled substances and dispense them out of office. I just didn't know what the delineation was.
It's defined, Dr. Popiel, in the consent agreement as dispense includes prescribed.
And he currently cannot prescribe opioids, and I don't think that he can prescribe benzo or benzodiazepines, but that benzodiazepines are appealable. After 1 year, which they are appealable now, but it's my understanding that he's currently not wishing to go down that route in his practice.
Okay. My objective in part is to clean up my reputation as much as possible, and the less cluttered the restrictions on my license are, the better from my point of view of removing legal stigma. But at this point, I do not have any current business plans to prescribe anything that is on that appealable list. But to the extent that I am trying to reformulate my business, I want as much flexibility as possible. But at this time, I do not have any specific intent.
Okay, so he would have to make a motion or come in front of the board to be able to prescribe those controlled substances in the future.
Correct.
Okay. As far as I'm concerned, you know, I have no problem removing the practice monitor based on her commentary as well. And that should Dr. Wyrick want to prescribe those controlled substances in the future, he can come in front of the board and state that case at that point. That's okay. My opinion.
So are we allowing the benzos to move forward? And if so, or if he's not doing it now, but if he wanted to, or do we allow it and then just have him submit those particular cases to the practice monitor?
I would think, Dr. Campbell, that would be due to the fact of the consent agreement and the issues that we had, I think that would be the most logical way to proceed.
Okay. Yeah, I'm fine with that.
And I'm sorry, yes. Benzos are allowed now? I apologize. I'm confused.
So for ease of, you know, paperwork, if the board is inclined to remove the practice monitor, so long as he is not writing for benzodiazepines and hypnotics, which are the basically I'm looking at the list of drugs on page 37. I'm just going to read it. Suboxone, gabapentin, diazepine, clonazepam, zolpidem, benzodiazepine, fluoxetine, phentermine, lorazepam, trazodone, soma, Xanax, and opioids.
I'm sorry, including their derivatives.
So as long as he's not writing for those drugs and certifying patients for medical marijuana, he would not need, the board is inclined to not require a practice monitor, correct?
And I'm sorry, if I may, I'm sorry to jump in, but he's got a permanent restriction on all opioids and certifying medical marijuana. So I read that as it's a permanent restriction. He can't do that. Those.
Okay, so the practice monitor is only for, I'm sorry,
So then if you're looking at, I think it was Dr. Popio's suggestion about just having a practice monitor, if you're allowing him now to prescribe what's under 7, which is the drugs that you just listed, the Soma and the Xanax,
mm-hmm.
then from what I understand, the motion to be would be the practice monitor would only be monitoring those files into where he wrote prescriptions for those drugs. But it's my understanding he can never write prescriptions for the controlled substances classified as opioids, and he can never certify for medical marijuana.
Okay. So my suggestion would just be to make it easier, and because it's not part of his current business plan, is to just say that he also can't write for the list of that starts with gabapentin on 37, unless and until he petitions the board and obtains approval for it. That way it's going to be cleaner to monitor.
So do we have to rewrite this consent agreement?
No, we would just, if this is the board's inclination, they could just do and offer an amendment to the consent agreement.
So for today, we're basically removing the practice monitor, and we're not addressing the benzo issue. And when he petitions the board in the future, we can address the benzo issue. But for now, we're going to vote on whether or not we're going to allow him to not have to deal with the practice monitor. And who knows what will happen at a future meeting if we approve the benzos and if he has to go through a practice monitor or not at that time. But for today, we're just going to do the first part.
Well, right now he can write for benzos. He can write for that list on 37 because he has the practice monitor. So my suggestion was to move that list on 37 to the things that he can't write for, and remove the practice monitor.
Or
and by an amendment.
We could remove the practice monitor for all prescriptions on that list other than hormones. Might be cleaner. I don't know if that's cleaner or not.
Note that I don't have a DEA license right now.
Dr. members of the board, I'm sorry, this is Gail. So if you're looking at 7 under the restrictions, is this petition that Dr. Wierick has before us now, is he requesting to write for those drugs? Because the consent agreement says respondent may petition the board in writing after 1 year. I don't know that he's petitioned us for that particular area.
I don't believe that my petition included that, but of course, relaxing anything possible is welcome.
I agree with you, Gail. The way I read this is that he would have to petition us for the ability to write these medications. So it seems like the idea of just allowing to remove the practice monitor, and then if he does want to write these in the future, he would have to petition us for allowing to be written for those, and then we would have to decide how to supervise at that point.
Right. Is that correct, Ms. Campbell?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That makes a lot more sense. I apologize.
I mean, today, to only deal with the practice monitor, the rest of these issues would have to be addressed at a different time.
Under a different petition, if you're so inclined to file one.
Yeah, to do so. I mean, my problem with the, we had originally put the practice monitor in there due to the erratic record keeping, et cetera. So that was done some time ago. Do you think that you would be able to work without a practice monitor, or do you need somebody to check every 10 charts of yours?
Is that addressed to me?
It's addressed to you.
Yes, I think that the practice monitor has given me feedback that I'm doing a good job with my charts, and I don't expect to change my charting habits.
Are you opposed to taking an 8-hour charting course?
At this point, I don't see where it's relevant since I have not only passed the jurisprudence exam, but also gone through in very great detail all the recommendations of the board so far as charting, and I've made sure that my charts reflect every component that is on the website.
So you're saying that you have down pat, subjective, objective, assessment, and plan. You're able to coordinate all that.
Yes, I believe that my practice monitor has indicated that I have addressed all necessary components of a SOAP note.
But
also take it and pass the pharmacology exam.
Board members, your thoughts on only dropping the issue of the practice monitor? The rest of this would stay intact.
This is Dr. Popiel. I think that's fair at this point. And, you know, if we have any interest in doing the controlled substances down the road, you can petition the board and we can have a conversation at that point.
I concur.
And you feel comfortable with him, Dr. Popiel, doing his not be monitored?
I do, you know, based on the commentary from the practice monitor, it seemed like, you know, he was doing a good job with that. So, you know, I think based on her commentary, I would feel comfortable allowing him to just proceed forward with doing the chart notes. You know, I definitely have, we'll cross the bridge of controlled substances down the road if that ever become present. But,
okay.
You know, you and I both remember the yeah. significance of this case and the time involved. So I appreciate your hesitancy as well.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a big decision. So I think Dr. Popiel put out a motion. I think Dr. Campbell, you seconded it. And so I will ask all those in favor, say aye.
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 Any nays? Okay. Motion passes. Adam, do you have any questions for us before we disconnect?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Let's move on. We are on basically at this point. Number 7, review consideration possible action regarding Colleen Huber. Do you want to do an executive session?
I'm sorry, Dr. Sadlick, I'm sorry to interrupt. This is Gail. Did you want to take 8, 9, and 10 ahead of that? I know these folks have been waiting all day.
Yes. Thank you. Let's do that. And then we'll backtrack into 7. So let's go ahead and move on to number 8. And this is Nicole, is it Lugers? Nicole, are you on the line?
Lugers,
okay.
Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, this is an application for endorsement from Connecticut. The license was issued 9/2016. Applicant passed all the required MPLEX examination for full Arizona scope. Applicant indicated an affirmative answer on one background question, disclosing an arrest and conviction for DUI in 2012. Source documents reflect the arrest and guilty plea. Applicant was fined $500, and her driver's license was suspended for 90 days. Applicant has been licensed in Connecticut, as I said, since 2016 with no disciplinary actions. Board staff recommends approval of the application.
And is Nicole on the line? No, Nicole. Okay. I'll make a motion that we accept her application for a medical license.
This is Dr. Popiel. I second that. Go ahead.
And all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay. Let's move on to next. Number 9, this is William Franklin, and it looks like we have him on the line. Ms. Anthony, can you give us a review of that?
Yes. Dr. Sadlik, members of the board, this is an application for reinstatement of an expired medical license. Applicant graduated from Sonoran University in October of 2008 and was licensed in Arizona 5/25/2010. Let the license expire 1/1 of 2014.
And Dr. Franklin, can you tell us what happened that you want to have your license expire?
Yes, I had moved to an unlicensed state and had been practicing there. It was a combination of I was not making a very good living. And then we had a son born, and it sort of lapsed in my mind. I forgot to send in everything, and then I decided that it had been like I was not needing it in North Carolina at the time. We've moved back since then, and so I began working to reinstate.
And have you been at all active in clinical medicine?
I have. Since I moved back to Arizona, I've been shadowing, and then I did a preceptorship. And I intend to continue to do those kinds of things until I feel more comfortable with my clinical skills that I wasn't allowed to use in North Carolina, mostly the injection therapies and things like that. I've been with Dr. Arneson, and he's allowed me to do, during the preceptorship, I was able to do some IMs and IV therapies.
How's your pharmacology?
Pharmacology is, needs brush up as well.
Okay. Where are you with your CMEs for the year then?
So my, CMEs that I owed are completed, and I am completing. I'm within 3 hours of opioids for this year as well.
Have you completed the opioid?
I've purchased the course. I have not taken it yet.
Okay. Have you looked at doing an 8-hour CME on charting SOAP, or do you feel that you've got that skill set under control?
I definitely could use a brush up on the electronics. I've never used that. Dr. Arneson doesn't do electric records either, and so those are going to be new to me. I do have another doctor, James Tuggle, that has been talking to me about coming in and working with him, shadowing with him, and then potentially maybe joining him.
Yeah, I was just looking, not necessarily for the EMR or electronics. I was just looking even for a paper, just following that logic of
subjective. Oh, okay. That part, yeah. And I've been doing that since before I attended naturopathic school. I was a hospital physiologist, exercise physiologist for 4 years.
Okay.
And we used it quite a bit.
Okay. All right, so you know how to follow the plan then. So in reference to number 9, any of the board members have any thought processes? So we can make a motion. I'll make the motion then to reinstate his expired medical license.
Dr. Puppy, I second that motion.
And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed?
Aye.
Okay, so everyone concurs. Okay, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Good luck, Dr. Franklin.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's move on to number 10. Is Dr. Mitchell on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Dr. Mitchell. This is for application for a specialty certificate.
That's correct. Dr. Salad, members of the board, Dr. Mitchell submitted an application for specialty certification in pediatrics. The PED ANP has been approved as an affiliate of the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians.
Okay, so this is actually a boarded, it's a boarded designation, not an association, but it's an actual board approved specialty. Dr. Mitchell, any comments?
Yeah, this is like ONC ANP, but PED ANP, and I think she's just applying to be recognized by the board as a naturopathic pediatrician.
Right.
Like the board recognized me as a naturopathic oncologist.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I make a motion that we recommend her for specialty certification in pediatrics.
Second. Yep. Go ahead.
Anyone opposed? No? Okay. Congratulations, Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you. Congrats.
Take care.
Thank you, Dr. Mitchell.
Let's move on. Let me digress. We have to go back. Did we want to go to executive session for number 7? I'll make a motion that we quickly move into executive for item number 7.
And Dr. Sadlick, is that to receive legal advice under A3 and to discuss, discuss pending litigation under A4?
Yes.
Okay. And Dr. Sadlick, I'm happy to move into executive session. I don't really have, if anybody has questions or wants to discuss anything, I don't have much to add other than what's in the memo.
Okay. Okay. Then we can forego executive session. Does any board member have a question, or does a board member want to move into executive?
Nope.
No?
No, if there's nothing that we need to, then just move forward.
All right. So we got number 7 done. Let's move on to number 11. And that would be our executive director, Ms. Anthony.
And board member, Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, nothing changed from my director report with the exception of the rules under F. I just wanted to let you know that I did attend the committee meeting, the GERC committee meeting on November 7th, and GERC approved both our dispensing rules that we worked on some time ago and the medical assistant education rules that we also worked on some time ago. So those two packages have been approved, and I think there's a 60-day they'll be effective within 60 days of the 7th. I'm working on some of the other packages regarding what we also discussed regarding the rules, and those will be moving through the Secretary of State's office and GERC, and I'll keep you posted on how those are moving.
Okay. Anyone have questions under number 11? No? Okay. Number 12 is future agenda items. Any board member have an agenda item they want placed?
Well, I just want to ask, what happened with the CME for that 20 unit that we've been asking?
Dr. Sadlick, members of the board, Dr. Spat, that is it within the other rule items that I've been working through on the other articles. I have to submit each article separately, so that's in the works.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any future agenda items beyond that? No. Call to the public, number 13. And we'll do our usual countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Nothing from that. And it's 4:23, and we have adjourned. Thank you, everybody, for hanging in there.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Good night.